Welcome, everyone. Appreciate the turnout today. We've got three general topic areas we're going to take up. First off, we're going to do an update on the transportation projects and what's going on, learn what's happening there. Then we're going to spend some time talking about simplifying and streamlining business regulation. And at the end, we've got three potential measures for introduction for the February session that people are going to advise us about. I will note that at least one person, Jeremy Rogers, is coming in on the second panel, and I'm going to give him the chance to talk when he gets here because he has to run out again. So when we hit a natural breaking point, we'll do that. So I want to start out then with transportation, and Director Garrett and your team, if you want to come up, that'd be great.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, appreciate the opportunity. I'm Matthew Garrett, Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation, and with me is Paul Mather. Paul is the Highway Division Administrator for the department. As you said, we are going to speak about three specific issues here. Mr. Mather is going to lead off here and speak about the transportation investments and the return on those investments in terms of the projects that have presented themselves across the state of Oregon, where we are with the various investments that have played themselves out over the years. And then we're going to turn our attention to the fiscal realities that this agency is facing and some of the challenges it's presenting from a business perspective as well as the condition of the transportation system. And then finally, we'll do a very brief update on the Columbia River crossing. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll turn it over to Mr. Mather if you'd like.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator for ODOT. Just want to quickly today just go through some of our major funding areas and just give you an update on how we're proceeding with those. I got a few examples of some projects in some of those areas that you may be interested in or kind of illustrative of how we're moving forward in those various programs. I'm going to cover today the Jobs and Transportation Act. I'm going to cover the OTIA 3 program and how we're doing with the bridge program, the ARRA, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, and finally Connect Oregon, and just give you again a quick update on all those. We're going to touch on those again later in the testimony as you'll kind of see our financial picture, but I'll just give you a current snapshot of where we're at. So the Jobs and Transportation Act passed 2009, House Bill 2001. In Section 64 of that bill, there was 37 projects that were specifically identified and then a number of additional local projects for Eastern Oregon that were identified as well later on. As we go through and track these projects, there's a number of things that we're doing, and the documentation that you have in front of you lists all the different projects, and our website lists all the different projects. But you'll notice that we've split many of these projects into different phases and different parts as we try to deliver these in a logical as well as an accelerated manner, trying to get as much of the work out as possible. So tracking the exact number of projects back to that 37 can be a little difficult, but we try to always go back to those 37 projects that were identified in the legislation. In total, six of the projects so far have been complete, 13 are under construction, and 39 are being designed or in the environmental process. And again, as I said, we have a website that there in my testimony as well as a complete list of the projects. I want to spend a little bit of time and just go through a couple examples of projects that are out there. But before I do, I just want to give you a little bit of context as to the payout or the development of these projects. And this chart here is to illustrate kind of where we are in the volume of projects that are going out, but also trying to illustrate the volume of dollars that are going out from these projects. As you can see, early in the program, we're getting up to speed and getting projects out, but the early projects, as you would expect, are the relatively smaller, simpler projects in the program. In 2013, specifically probably the bid season of 2013, is when we really see a significant amount of projects going out from a dollar volume standpoint. And then from there, the program starts to tail off in numbers as well as volume. So we're still ramping up in the development of these projects and the expenditures in this program. Just to touch on a couple projects, the first one I wanted to highlight was the I-5 at I-205 interchange. I'm sure many of you have driven through there this summer to see the construction that's been going on to add the additional lane, or what we call an auxiliary lane, between the North Wilsonville exit and I-205 to facilitate traffic through that area. There's about 100,000 vehicles that pass through that area today, and this will complement the lane we added southbound the year before as part of the ARRA. ARRA program. I got a couple slides, pictures of work that's going on. Much of the work was done at night to facilitate traffic going through the area. There was some that was done during the daytime, but work to keep traffic moving through the area. Some of the local impacts: the prime contractor for this project was Kerr Contractors of Woodburn. There was local subcontractors from throughout the area, including Wilsonville, Aurora, Hillsboro, Forest Grove, Portland, Tigard, Sandy, Clackamas, Brooks, North Plains, McMinnville, and others that benefited from jobs that were created as part of this project. The next project I'd just like to highlight is a project in Southern Oregon. This is a climbing lane project on I-5 just north of Sutherland. In this project, it's an example where we took an existing project we had in our program to repave this section of the interstate and combine the two together to reduce our administrative cost and gain some efficiencies. Through that, as well as a very good bidding environment, we were able to not only construct the southbound climbing lane, but in the picture I've got here is actually showing the northbound climbing lane that we were able to add to the project because of favorable bids and savings from combining the projects. This project is actually a little bit behind schedule. We were hoping to have it done this fall, but it'll carry over until next spring before we finish this project up. The prime contractor is Tidewater, which bases in Brookings. There's a number of local trucking firms that are from the area that are also involved. Canyonville, Grants Pass, Drain, they're also contribute to this project and benefit from the revenue or the jobs created. The last project I wanted to illustrate was one of the smaller county projects in eastern Oregon. This is a project in the LaGrande area, Pierce Road. It's one that was identified by the Area Commission on Transportation over there as providing better access to the interstate, better access to the airport, as well as an industrial park, and divert truck traffic from the interstate as it heads out on the Wallawa Lake Highway. So here's a picture I have here of the project, of a section before it was complete. You can see it's not real conducive to truck traffic, the pavement condition there, shoulders, so forth. And here's a picture of a different section that's been completed, much more conducive to attracting truck traffic both to the industrial area as well as a bypass of the Grand Interchange. This project was designed by a local engineering firm, Anderson Perry and LeGrand. High Desert Aggregate and Paving, based in Terrebonne, was the successful contractor to build the project. Moving on to the ARRA, or the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act.
Excuse me, Senator Starr.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Before he goes past the JTA, I have a specific question. Can you talk a little bit about the process that you're underway at the moment concerning the Newburgh-Dundee bypass? The one project that has the most number of dollars allocated in the JTA. Can you talk about where that is in the process? I continue to hear from folks on the ground in Yamhill County a level of frustration that, you know, this project specifically funded at a high amount by the legislature, and yet there seems to be the impression, I don't know if it's reality, but it's impression that the department continues to drag its feet and not want to build this project. Can you talk about where you are in the process and confirm to this legislative committee that the department is committed to follow through with the legislative mandate to build the project?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, indeed we are. In fact, we've been working closely with the mayors of the community involved to keep on a schedule we developed with them this summer and keep us on track to finish the environmental document. We expect a record of decision in March of next year, and we seem to be on track with that. This month we're providing Federal Highway Administration with the documentation they need to do their part, and that process should be completed in March based on that schedule. We also have been working with the community from the financial constraint portion of the project. In the In the original legislation, it was assumed there would be a federal earmark that would complete the funding for the phase that was envisioned in the Jobs and Transportation Act based on the developments in Congress. None of the earmarks for those projects look like they're going to happen. And so we've been working with the communities to develop contingency plans of either scaling the project back, finding additional funding. And so we've been working on that with the Newburgh-Dundee project as well. And so the limits of the project has been changed to fit within the amount of resources that we do have for the project. And there's been some discussion also about the new ending and beginning points of the project has been a point that we've been working with the community about.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm.
Gosh, there's so many things I'd like to say. Has the department spent any money on right-of-way acquisition out of the money allocated in the JTA for this project?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, I believe we have. I don't have those numbers in front of me, but I believe we have.
Can you provide those to me?
Yes, I can.
And then, Mr. Chair, additional follow-up. You mentioned the state of affairs in Washington, D.C. I think we're all acutely aware of challenges that we're facing as it relates to federal funds for transportation projects. Does the department continue to maintain a lobbyist in Washington?
Chairman Byers, Senator Starr, yes, we do.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. So in the event that you're not lobbying for specific earmarks, why do you continue to retain a lobbyist in Washington, D.C.? And my sense is that you'll continue to work with the Oregon delegation to find avenues to fund particular transportation projects outside of a specific earmark process. Can you just inform the committee about how you might do that?
That's excellent.
I think in addition to that, it would inform the community in Newburgh and Dundee and Yamhill County that the department is in fact in favor of constructing this project if there was some level of certainty or comfort level that the department was actually utilizing the well-paid lobbyist the department has in Washington to solicit appropriate funds for this particular project. Can you just comment on that, please?
Certainly can. Chairman Byers, Senator Starr, it's an excellent question. Let me assure you that while at the federal level they are saying there are no earmarks, that hasn't stopped us from promoting the investments that we see in transportation that has, I think, multiple returns on investment. So again, it's not a dirty word to us. We continue to bang home the message. I think the investment of the lobbyists back in Washington, D.C. plays itself out on a couple different levels. One, project-specific levels. And with regard to Newburgh-Dundee, I can tell you we are advocating for that project, and we have in terms of the recent Tiger grants, the Tiger 3 grants, Newburgh-Dundee being one of those projects that we are promoting and have advocated for with the delegation. It comes with several other projects across the state that we think, hey, this is a good investment. This is going to yield multiple benefits to the state of Oregon. The health of the transportation system and the health of the economy. So we keep moving on those specific funding and financing efforts, as well as the policy conversation, because again, the policy conversations have huge implications to investment strategies and investment streams. And we dedicate a lot of time of those lobbyists to inform and hopefully favor and position the state of Oregon to take advantage of the language that will be inserted in the new reauthorization. Whenever that comes, we are pushing very hard to make sure the ratios, the formula funding that come to the states, that the state of Oregon is positioned to receive the highest levels and highest percentages that we can. So I can tell you that the investment we make with those good folks, in the past they have brought home a lot of money to the state of Oregon working with the congressional delegation as well as the committee staff, and I think that's extremely important. We have lobbyists who have excellent relationships. As a matter of fact, they have worked in the policy committee, the appropriations committee that inform those conversations as well. So from a policy program and just basic federal practice, our conversations continue to bang home that message to try to position the state of Oregon to bring home as much federal money as we can. We've been successful in the past, and while we are going through some very uncertain times, our posture hasn't changed on that front.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
Senator, you know, I would take a different perspective, I think, than what some were saying on that. I actually think with the change in the earmark process, it probably is going to be more beneficial to us to have representation back there because it's going to be bureaucrats making the decisions. who don't know anything about Oregon as opposed to our congressional delegation. And I think the congressional delegation is going to need all the help they can get in that process, and the states that have the best relationship with the bureaucrats are going to be the ones that win.
Mr. Chair, my comments weren't
intended. I don't like that, but I think that's reality.
My comments weren't intended to diminish the role of our paid lobbyists in Washington, but to understand the new tactic that they're utilizing in order to facilitate Oregon's interests in Washington. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Good.
Okay.
Just quickly continuing on to my update around the ARRA funds. As you may know, Oregon received about $500 million total in ARRA funds. All those projects have been obligated to projects, and as of the end of September, we have spent almost 91% of those funds that we received through the ARRA program. So we're largely through that program and just through the wrapping up of a few projects that we have left in the program. Turning to the OTEA 3, specifically the OTEA 3 bridge program, which was $1.3 billion portion of that program. That project continues just to wind down. All the projects, all the bridges are out to contract. We have a number of large projects. The Sandy River Bridge and the Willamette River Bridge in Eugene are wrapping up, and we'll kind of keep the program going. But as far as new projects going out, we've completed that. To date, we've repaired or replaced 255 bridges, 15 bridges that we have under construction with those ones that I noted. To the Connect Oregon, going back to Connect Oregon 1, again, Connect Oregon is funded with Oregon Lottery funds for non-highway projects. Connect Oregon 1, 2, and 3 were at $100 million. The Connect Oregon 4, which was passed last session, was at the $40 million level. Connect Oregon 1, 35 projects have been complete, 3 under construction, $94.8 million of the $99.5 have been expended. In Connect Oregon in 2, 20 projects are complete, 10 are in design or construction, approximately $80 million of the $99.5 have been approved for that program. Connect Oregon 3, 5 projects are completed, the remaining 35 projects are in design or construction phase, approximately $19.5 million have been expended of the $94.5 million. Connect Oregon 4, the applications for that program have gone out, and we close on those applications next week, and we'll go through the similar process we did for Connect 1, 2, and 3 and the selection of those. Our commission is due to gavel down on those this spring, and we'll be aggressively moving towards agreements to get those projects on the ground. So that covers kind of the four major funding sources we have for projects, and just a quick update on where we are with projects. Any questions?
Thank you.
Excellent. So continuing on, turning our attention to the funding picture, and I think Senator Starr, this is a good entree to the challenges of the uncertainties of what's playing itself out at the federal level. But, you know, we have some challenges here on the state level as well. And while we celebrate, and we should celebrate the investments that have played themselves out since 2001 and 2003, and I will tell you, specifically the Connect Oregon and then the Jobs and Transportation Act, the investment that this legislature, you and your colleagues of the past legislature made, was unprecedented. You talked to folks across the nation of how in these troubled times could you make an investment, could you increase the gas tax to fund projects. It just didn't happen, but it happened in the state of Oregon. Again, it's because they are investments that yield dividends in terms of paychecks in people's hands, healthier transportation system, which I think makes a healthier economy. So we have much to celebrate, and we should. But there are some fiscal clouds that have hung over us, and a fiscal challenge faces. And what I would like to do is walk through these various factors at play that are challenging the way we do business and are challenging the condition, the very healthy condition we have in our system right now. But as we forecast to the future, that it's going to be much more difficult to make sure we preserve and maintain this transportation asset. So the funding trends are downward. They are. Those are just the realities that we are going to adapt to. So I'll walk through the factors at play and then some of the direction that we have imposed as an agency to make sure that with this challenge we are putting forth solutions. But first, let's just almost through a laundry list walk through some of the issues that are presenting challenges to this. Debt service, again, conscious decisions made to bond monies, to jumpstart the projects, to put the boots on the ground, so to speak. But that said, as we play this out over time, by 2015, roughly $210 million will be bonded. Now, that's about 25% of our budget here. So you can see, when you lock up money for 20 to 30 years here, the flexibility of working your financial plan is somewhat restricted here. That becomes a challenge as we move forward in terms of how we address fiscal
issues. Director Deere, are you saying that number
210
is that's the annual or biennial cash flow off the revenue stream that would be committed to debt service?
That's correct. That's
correct. Over 25 or 30 years?
That's correct. So you can go back starting in 2001 with the initial OTIA investment, scale out to 25, 30 years, and you can see that we're locked up over the years.
The question I have is how locked are we if the interest rates change? Does that change your projections?
Chair Beyer, Senator Jarrett, that's an excellent question. Yeah, we are constantly monitoring the rates and actually refinancing when we think we can get better rates here. So we have a very aggressive fiscal discipline associated with how we bond, the types of bonds, and I won't get into the nuance of the bonding conversations because I would be in deep water very quickly here, but I can tell you that we were looking at that and we're trying to take advantages of the market when we can to save money. But when all is said and done, the credit card will continue to come over that period of time.
I assume that's the treasurer's job.
But we help. I think that the second factor at play is the declining revenues at the state level. The bottom line here is we see significant investment over time with the OTIAs, with the Connect Oregons, with the Jobs and Transportation Act, and with the federal stimulus dollars that peaks, that creates a significant volume. But it's had a masking effect, for all intents and purposes, on the direction that the state funding has gone. We made a projection over the period of 2008 to 2015. And what we're seeing now as we continue to update our forecast is those assumptions are about 7% less, or roughly $500 million different. We had forecast over this period of time to collect somewhere between $7.4 billion, maybe just a little bit more. The latest forecast we have done is we will generate roughly $6.9 billion. So you can see a significant reduction in the cash that we will have available to us. So our volumes are shrinking in terms of what we can afford and what we can't. The cost of doing business, and this affects all businesses here, but just the feeding the beast, the footprint of the organization, whether it's the monies that we send to the basic highway maintenance and preservation, that's pretty much state money, that's where we have to use. The personnel cost, whether it's health care issues, whether it's retirement type issues, those are starting to eat up the monies we have available here. And so the cost of doing business is a factor that's challenging us as we look to the future. We spoke to the uncertainty. Yes, sir.
Senator Atkinson?
What funds exactly are being eaten up?
We pay. Let's just say the health care costs, the personal service costs, out of state money. That's the money that we use. So again, those state dollars that we can use to leverage or match federal dollars to bring in more money. We're just.
How much is that increase?
I don't have a specific number, but I will get that to you.
The thing that I find interesting about that is, of all the years in the building, I don't think I've ever, in an interim committee, heard that, even though we've all thought that percentage is increasing. So if it's increasing 10%, which is a number that we use a lot, we'd be very curious to know.
Well, and again, the increases are coming out of my hide in terms of the budget. So again, it's biting into the monies that I have available to deliver product.
Thank you.
We spoke about the uncertainty at the federal level. Again, the simply put, the expenditures are exceeding the revenues by about $15 billion at the specific to the Federal Highway Trust Fund here. Discussions are taking place of how do you remediate that. There are really two pathways being looked at. The first being find some additional monies to make it whole. And that comes somewhere between $12 and $15 billion depending on the time frames you're looking at. And those are the discussions that are playing themselves out in the United States Senate and the House as well here. The pathways to get there bring with them some policy discussions. On the House side, domestic drilling, offshore drilling is a pathway that they believe they could generate the monies to cover that revenue expenditure deficit here. And the Senate is still looking for a pathway here. So they are working to that to try to bring us even, or very close to even, maybe just a little bit short. And that's fine. We would certainly embrace that because that gives us some certainty and we can go forth and plan based on that information. The other reality, if indeed there is not a new revenue source identified, is to align with revenues here. Again, shrink it down. And what we would see is the conversations playing themselves out on the highway side of a reduction of about 30%. And what that means for the state of Oregon is a reduction between $150 and $175 million on an annual basis coming to the state of Oregon. It's worse on the transit side. It drops down to about a 40% cut. So you can see, depending on the pathway they choose, it's very difficult for us to plan into the future, not knowing exactly what monies will come our way. Thus, so we start to look at how we accommodate that. The cost of materials, the cost of inflation, the purchasing power is decreased. That's another given in terms of some of the challenges we face. We are seeing fuel efficiency, the composition of the fleet. This is a conversation that touches several different policy discussions playing themselves out at the Department of Transportation. But again, we have seen since 2004 fuel efficiency increase by about 16%. As we project into the future, the CAFE standards, the fuel mileage standards. By 2025, the administration has put forth a direction to increase those to 54.5 miles per gallon. Now, that would suggest to me that the technology we have to date, which gets us about 24 miles a gallon, it's probably going to change. It may migrate away from the internal combustion engine to some type of fuel cell, electric vehicle, some new technology. What that does is it compromises the gas tax as a sustainable revenue stream to invest in the transportation system. Now again, Mr. Witte and the good folks of the Innovative Public Partnership, or Private Partnership Unit within ODOT, and the Road User Finance Task Force are looking into a mileage-based fee option to look at the transition from a gas tax to a new funding source for transportation. That's playing itself out. But again, when all is said and done, if this migration takes place, and again, we're talking 2025, so not very far away, our revenue source starts to dry up and the investment back into the system is compromised. I'd be remiss if I didn't say I've talked pretty much about the highway portfolio. There are deficits in the non-highway portfolio. Again, the sustainable flow of funds to transit and rail does not exist in the state of Oregon. It's to the good graces of you and your colleagues who would give us some general fund monies to fund transit for senior and disabled type transit activity and such. Rail is another challenge in terms of money being made available by the federal administration, but as quickly as it appeared, it seems to be taken away, and we're not seeing that money available. If we are going to be a Department of Transportation, we're going to have to offer options and a holistic view of that. So rather than, you know, living and dying on episodic infusions of money, we would like a sustainable system in terms of funding the non-highway side of that. So those are the challenges. Rather than just leave you with that, I'm going to tell you what this agency is doing specific to the implications to the agency and the system. First and foremost, as our state monies are being consumed, whether it's through debt service or the purchasing power is going away or just the cost of doing business, I think it is prudent that we align our revenues with our expenditures here. And so what I have asked my agency to do across all portfolios is by 2015 to be 5% smaller. Now, that's the equivalent of about 225 people. It's a savings of roughly $50-some million. But we do believe that as the investments we saw in 2000, which had us at a volume of about $350 million annual volume of delivering services. When I forecast out to 2015 and I look at all the trends, I am now down to around $225 million, and I have not adjusted for inflation. If I adjust for inflation, then I'm going to be around $200 million of annual contract volume. I think on my highway portfolio, and specifically the project delivery side, I've got to align to our revenues. And so we have an effort underway right now. We've engaged because it gives us a longer glide path to implement through a benign mechanism of attrition. We think as the ebb and flow of people coming in and out of this organization happens here, we can start to hold those positions and start to reduce the workforce to better align with the revenues that we have. And again, we think it's better to do it now than wait till 2015, where we may have a crisis depending on what the future brings. And I am not anticipating any funding of significance coming from the federal government, nor do I anticipate another federal capital program coming at the state. I can't make that assumption. I've got to deal with the realities that are challenged here. So we're moving forward to maintain and preserve the asset, moving forward to align the structure and the architecture of the agency with the revenues that we have, thinking we'd be more lean and deliver the services as best we can. I think with that, what I'd like to do now, Mr. Chair, is turn to Paul so he can speak about the conditions of the transportation system and the implications of the fiscal realities to that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator, quick question.
You said a reduction of 5%?
Correct.
Is that what you said? Project volume or agency overhead?
Agency overhead for all intents and purposes, but we're also looking at different levels of service. I mean, you'll see activities in terms of maintenance activities, which we're trying to protect, but we had a conversation play itself out up on Mount Hood at the government camp rest area. It's a rest area that we lease. It's about a $200,000 biennial cost associated with running that. We're looking at those types of investments to try to scale back to align the revenues with the expenditures, or the expenditures with the revenues.
Okay. Quick follow-up. It has often been noted that in department downsizing or cost-cutting measures in the past, engineers were laid off or let go or whatever through attrition, but then that work was still needs to be done by the department. It was shifted to the private sector and then was hired back, and people allegedly at a higher cost. I've never seen numbers. I don't know if it was a higher cost, if it was a lower cost. I'm wondering, you know, how much downsizing effort will be real cost downsizing versus just shifting it from overhead to project cost?
Chair Beyer, Senator Edwards, it's a fair question. The bottom line is, again, I'm looking close at the revenue, and because I don't have a certain number here, it's just unpredictable. The variables haven't been put into the equation, so I really don't know what I'm aligning to. But we will monitor that. But I think we do need to align with the revenues that we have, the volumes that we need to deliver, and I'll have a workforce that can do that. That's been the discipline at ODOT, and it's been about $350 million a year. And there is a philosophy and a discipline that we've applied at that 350 level that about 70% of the work would be done in-house and 30% would be outsourced, specifically on the design. We know that we contract out 100% of the construction of the project. OTIA came in, and another policy conversation was had that rather than building a workforce to equal the size of the expenditure of the big OTIA 3 investment, which would have been 500 people, the decision was to outsource that. So the private sector rides the cycle as expenditures go down. I will tell you the state of Washington chose the other route. They actually built up and they are in the process right now of laying off 800 of their folks because they built that project delivery capacity with their own people. So it's something we watch here, and understanding there may be policies decisions, how to manage programs, who to manage them with, and then there are collateral arguments on both sides. The discussion about does it cost more, I'll be very honest with you, Senator, there's been mixed messages as does it cost more or does it not. How do you get apples to apples at best here? So, I won't grasp at that specter right now. We've been there to some extent with the OTA 3 investment. But again, I think in a benign fashion, through attrition, and watching exactly what the revenue levels are, we will try to prevent a wide swing of the pendulum and try to hold it tight and really align with the revenues. That's the discipline we're trying to apply.
What you're really addressing there is the engineering cost.
Pretty much the design cost as well. Yeah. And again, as I said, what I'm trying to do, because you can see if you look at our budget, the majority of our investment is going toward preserving and maintaining this multi-billion dollar asset. That's consistent with our Oregon Transportation Plan. We get the infusions and investments like the Jobs and Transportation Act that surgically strike at capacity type issues. But I'm trying to protect that side. But again, as the volume comes down, it will hit Mr. Mather's project delivery site significantly. And if the feds come in, let's just say they can't find the monies, you've got a 30 or plus percent cut coming, and we'll have to align with that.
Okay. Before we get into the next one, I'm going to ask you if we can kind of hold that off a second. I've got the governor's office, Scott Nelson, who's got to be in another committee at 3 o'clock, and I'm just going to try and run him in very quickly.
Sure.
Let him talk about it. Hopefully he's here. This one, we're dipping into the streamlining and regulatory area. And what we're really, the committee's really looking at here is we've had a history going back to the last session of trying to find ways to position the state for growth, get government out of the way where it doesn't make any sense to be in the way. And so what we're looking for is specific instructions. Scott has the, come on up, Scott, has the responsibility for the governor has created a regulatory task force. And Scott, I was just saying what the committee is looking for is everybody talks about eliminating regulatory barriers and streamlining and all that. We're looking for specific, and I know you're working through this, specific things that the legislature can do to get us moving again. So with that little bit of intro, it's yours.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. What I might do here is just begin by reading a few lines from the governor's memo that started the group. And to your point, Mr. Chairman, this is, as you know, a work in progress. You've been involved. And I think that we will have specific recommendations to the legislature. May 2012 is the timeline for the final report to be delivered. I should also say that Fred Granum, the Attorney General's Special Counsel to Business, is the one who is leading this effort, and he unfortunately couldn't be here today. I'm an extremely poor facsimile of Fred in many ways, but certainly on these precise issues. So I may end up deferring a significant amount to him and reverting to the committee. But let me just begin by noting a few lines from the memorandum the governor produced that started the group. The 2010 Oregon Business Plan, presented last December, identified 10 initiatives to promote high-wage job growth. With the help of the legislature, my administration has made significant progress toward nearly every one of these initiatives. However, more work needs to be done. As such, I write this memo to initiate a concerted effort on yet one more of the identified areas, streamlining regulatory and permitting processes. Oregon has a rich and unique approach to protecting its natural resources and its people, and I do not intend for this effort to address the underlying substantive decisions and values reflected in our laws. However, I do believe that there are many places in the actual implementation of those laws where, over time, regulatory and permitting structures have been allowed to become sluggish and create unnecessary delays and uncertainty, causing harm to our business environment. In short, this effort will create a roadmap for how our state government will deliver services with greater efficiency and coherence in the years ahead. I believe there is plenty of room to improve several key permitting and regulatory processes to enhance timeliness and certainty without sacrificing the values that we Oregonians hold dear. With the help of key stakeholders, including the Attorney General, a work group and advisory team will make both short-term and long-term recommendations to me. These groups will be made up of agency directors, legislators, local economic development officials, and business owners, and the project will be carried out as outlined in the attached project charter. The charter goes on to give a timeline for activities related to the two reports and to talk about the makeup of the group. With that, an initial proposal on the specific measures identified in the Oregon Business Plan is going to be produced for the governor before the business summit on December 12th, and I think we'll have a significant amount of commentary during the business summit on those initial identified recommendations. And then the advisory team and the work group will create a longer report for May 2012 that creates a roadmap for more efficient regulatory and permitting processes in Oregon. Essentially, Fred, I think, wants to have a best practices manual come out in May 2012.
Well, I have to say, Scott, I'm a bit of a skeptic. Every governor that I've watched in the last five has come in saying we're going to do regulatory streamlining and spent a lot of time talking about it, but not a criticism, but we haven't gotten very far with it. And I think a lot of that has to do with, you know, whether it becomes a priority of the executive or not. I appreciate Governor Kitzhaber's saying this and putting this out there. I hope he commits to it. And I just want to say again that at least this committee is ready to move quickly on anything that any specific suggestions that people bring forward that make sense, that we can do something about. And I'm always a little frustrated, and I'll say that to everybody who's going to testify today. It really doesn't help us to have generalities. If people have specific ideas, we want to hear those that we can turn into legislation and do something about quickly. We're very aware of the state of Oregon's economy, both in terms of what it's doing on the human side and what it's doing in terms of the lack of revenue coming into this state. We'll hear that again in another day. So we're supportive of what you're doing, and we want to move quickly on anything we can. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions or comments from the committee?
Senator. I would just like to kind of reiterate what he said, and that is give us specifics, give us bills. You know, rhetoric is pretty cheap, and it's cheap from both sides. So I think that this committee is ready to move in streamlining. I take a look at a lot of regulations that sit within DCPS, for example. I just feel that if you're going to look at regulations, you have to look at the agency that's controlling those. A lot of those were done by rule, and I think a lot of them can be rolled back.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Chairman, if I may, I should mention that we would love to hear specific situations that any of you are aware of that we might be able to look at and use as examples.
Sure.
And address.
Senator Atkinson.
Thank you. I'm not supportive. I think that we're drowning in task force advisory committees and work groups. I have tried for about 6 months to talk to the governor's office to give specifics. I can't get my phone calls returned. I don't know if that's me or if that's just how the governor's office operates with the Oregon Senate. Not sure. Maybe it's a partisan thing. But the Oregon Business Committee completely blew it when they forgot the fact that Oregon cannot create capital. There's no capital market here. And without capital, you can't have a business. So we are nothing but a flyover state, basically because we've got lots of task forces, advisory committees, and work groups, working collaboratively, whatever the hell that means. And we don't generate any capital. Capital in this country is in Seattle, Los Angeles, and San Francisco. It's not in Portland. So, I mean, I'm really happy that we've got another task force and stakeholders and lobbyists and people who've got a vested interest in all these things. But the bottom line is you can't generate capital. And it is the legislative branch of government's job to fix specifics, not the executives. So, you know, I'm really happy that we've got all these groups and we're going to have all these stakeholders, all these task forces, but it is the legislative branch, not the executive branch, that sets the policy. So, you know, I'm glad that there's another task force advisory team work group, but it is the legislative who is the only elected task force advisory team work group that makes the policy.
If I may...
I'm sorry. I'm very upset. I've had it with this governor. I can't get my phone calls returned. I mean, you're saying you're looking for specifics. Check your voicemail.
Well, I apologize, Senator. If any of those calls have come to me, I'm not aware of them. I will be glad to come to wherever you would like me in the next week to
talk
about
this. I've lost confidence.
Fair enough. I hope that that is not the experience of others, and I'm willing to do anything I can do to help make up for that.
Don't put me on a task force.
Indeed, that is duly noted. I will just say that this originally began as a bill that Senator Telfer put forth. So this specific task force, in fact, because that wasn't a successful measure in the last legislature, we agreed to take up on her behalf.
Thank you. Anything else? Thank you, Scott.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Now, Matt and Paul, we're going to finish up on this.
Mr. Chair, member of the committee, again, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator. I just wanted to follow up on the points that Director Garrett was making and give you a little bit of illustration on what this is going to mean to the system. So what's it going to mean to our bridges, to our pavements, to our sidewalks, to traffic signals, the different features that we see out there in our different transportation system. As our investments go down, as the revenue goes down, our investments go down, both the state and federal level, what does that translate into the condition of our system, of our bridges that we travel over, the highways that we travel on? So I'm just going to talk about bridges and pavements specifically, but they're representative samples of what the rest of the system, the condition that it's in. So talking about bridges, if many of you may remember, in 2001 we came with the Bridge Options Report, which laid out the needs that we have in bridges throughout the state, and that represented about $5 billion of need that we have to deal with the bridges that were built in the 50s, 60s, and 70s with about a 50-year design life for those bridges that are coming due and we need to deal with. With the passage of the OTA3 legislation, we addressed $1.3 billion of that in a very strategic way on the key freight routes of the state to secure those routes for the next 20 years. That's going to buy us time with bridges, but eventually we have those other bridges that we have not addressed in the OTA3 program that we're going to have to deal with. Part of the revenue we used to generate for the OTA3 bridge program was bonding our existing bridge money. So when we look at our bridge funds that we have historically, we've been spending about $100 million a year in bridges. With the bonding and the reduced revenue that Director Garrett talked about, that's going to reduce to about a $50 million a year bridge program, which means we're not going to be replacing any bridges with that program. The $50 million is going to be used to put repairs in place for bridges, whether it's painting bridges, whether it's repairing different elements of the bridge. We won't be replacing bridges. Some of the things we are going to be doing to maximize the amount of money we do have in bridges and keep the conditions of our bridges up as high and as long as we can, we're going to be giving priority to those major structures that we have in the state. The coastal bridges, the bridges over the Columbia, those major bridges where financially, if they were to fail, would be extremely expensive to replace. We're going to continue to give priority to those freight corridors that we identified in the OTA3 program. Those are valuable corridors for the economy, which was identified in the Bridge Options Report, and we need to continue to focus on what real resources we have in those programs, in those routes. We're also going to be continuing to develop new technology. Even through the life of the OTA3 program, we've done research and to understand our bridges more. We're going to continue that and hopefully find additional ways that we can maximize the life out of the structures that we do have. Practical design, which is another element of the JTA, is another element that we'll be able to apply to our projects to maximize the resources that we have out there and, again, stretch those bridge funds that we have as far as we can. On the pavement side, a similar story. Other than it happens much more quickly on the pavement side than the bridges, bridges happen over a lifetime of 50 to 100 years. Pavements are typically in the 10 to 20 year time frame that we see deterioration or changes in pavement condition rating. Much of our pavement condition rating is what we call in the fair condition. And so when you look at whether it's the roof of your house or your status of your car or your pavement conditions, while that pavement is in the good condition, there's very little we spend on maintenance or the cost to rehabilitate that. And that stays at that for a fairly long time, but when it starts deteriorating, it deteriorates at an accelerating rate. And much of our system is down on that accelerating rate part of the curve, and it doesn't take much to move from that fair condition to a poor to a very poor condition in a fairly rapid time frame. So again, we're going to take the resources we do have and stretch those as far as we can. Looking at the projected resources that we do have, typically, like I said, we try to rehabilitate pavements about every 20 years or put a asphalt lift a pavement over the top of them every 20 years. With our current funding, we're on about a 1 out of every 47-year cycle to get back to a full treatment for a piece of pavement. So we're going to see our pavements deteriorate over the next several years. Probably the best example of that is on the interstate. For the last 20, maybe even 30 years, we've had very good pavement conditions on the interstate, which we've kind of taken for granted. Looking ahead even 5 years from now, that is going to change from a 90% fair or better down to about an 80% fair or better, and you're going to see conditions on the interstate, much like we see today on our secondary routes, where we have patches, we have potholes, we have pavement issues that we're dealing with.
Excuse me, Paul. Senator Durant.
I actually have two quick questions. I sit on a committee that deals with preparedness, especially tsunamis and earthquakes. What level of earthquake are we preparing? If we're going to redo these bridges, what level of earthquake can they sustain?
Chair Beyer, Senator Gerard, with the new bridges that we're replacing, we're meeting current code for all earthquake for the zone that they're in. So it depends on the zone you're in, whether you're on the coast or here.
So if you're on the coast, it's being about a 9, is that?
Right. Cascadia.
Right.
Cascadia, okay.
Right. So those are for all our new construction. Our existing bridges, we don't have a...
Eastern Oregon is about a 6.
Yeah, okay.
The second question I have, we were talking about the asphalt breaking down. And ever since I've been in politics, there's always been a question of asphalt versus concrete and the ratio of return. With the price of oil being the way it is, and it just seems to me like that may have flipped over and it might be more economical to be using concrete. So I just thought I'd let you weigh in on that argument.
Senator, good question. We get that quite often. Typically what drives that decision for us, we look on a case-by-case basis, but the traffic control it would take to put the concrete pavement out there. To do that, you essentially have to completely close off the lane for 28 days. Much of our system, the freeway being the best example, we're not able to accommodate traffic in a single lane or in a permanent lane reduction for that amount of time. Much of our paving or resurfacing that we do, you'll notice, is done at night to deal with the traffic congestion issues. That's the major driving point in making the selection between asphalt or concrete.
Interesting.
So just to finish up on pavements, we're going to see again deterioration in the various pavements that we have throughout the state. Some of the things that we are going to be doing, again, to stretch the dollars that we do have, is re-looking at the amount of money we spend in our district highways, our regional highways, and on the interstate, and refocusing more of the money on the interstate with the higher speeds and the safety concerns of the pavement condition on the interstate. We're going to try to keep the interstate pavement conditions up as high as possible, but that's going to mean our secondary highways are going to deteriorate more and faster. We're also going to be looking at some new things for us that you see for cities and counties fairly regularly, but things like chip seal or really thin treatments. Typically, we haven't tried those on state highways because, again, the volume of traffic that we deal with typically isn't conducive to that, but we're going to be venturing into many different technologies with pavement and different types of treatment on those thin treatments or those low costs to just to preserve the asset that we do have out there. We're also going to be focusing the dollars that we do have on preservation. Typically, when we go through a city and we pave a downtown area, there's a lot of requests for new sidewalks, for bulb outs, street furniture, entrance treatments, different things that we fund out of our highway projects. We're going to be saying no more often to those type of features that we see in our system and focusing strictly on the condition of the pavement and the protection of that asphalt or asset in the pavement. So we're going to be saying no to many of those requests for additions to our projects. So those are just the highlights of some of the things we're going to be doing. Again, it's a representative sample of what our culverts, our signals, our other assets that we're managing and having to make the same decisions in managing those assets.
Questions or Paul?
Are you finished or are we?
Yeah.
I got to throw this at you. You guys got handed the hot potato of hot potatoes, and that was Owen Project. Is there any way that you could do me a favor and just shoot it and kill it?
Well, Chair Barnes, Senator Girard, at one time I'd be right there with you. We were given the charge to carry forth, and actually we have pivoted and we're moving in a new direction. Significantly scaled down. There's a discipline to it. The architecture to deliver a communication piece of infrastructure is moving forward. The bottom line is it is a critical communication network that's needed for our folks, for the Oregon State Police, and for those first responders. So we are moving to, in a very disciplined manner, and a much smaller $146 million investment to make sure that our folks can communicate when they're out in the field.
I just have to, ham radios worked a hell of a lot better in the tsunami over in Japan. 2 cents on the dollar that we're spending for Owen, and Owen would be obsolete in a tsunami. So I'm glad we're scaling it down. I'm sorry that you guys ended up with it because, yeah, it's just had a bad history.
Yeah, no, I agree with the history part. Okay. Mr. Chairman, now I appreciate the opportunity to give the committee a brief update on the Columbia River Crossing, where we've been. The last time we spoke with committee, we have moved and made significant progress in moving this project forward. First and foremost, after roughly 6.5 years of working the environmental process known as the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, we have published the final environmental impact study. This was the culmination of work with our local partners. And we have yielded a body of work that engaged what I think is probably the most robust outreach effort that a transportation project has gone through. I would share with you, leading up to the publication of this document, we had over 1,000 public meetings. We had 12,000 comments on this project. More to come, there is no question about it, but the transparency, the accountability, and the aggressive nature of our outreach cannot be overstated. With the publication on September 23rd of this EIF, we take it to the next stage, and that's in the hands of the Federal Highway Administration and the Federal Transit Administration to secure a record of decision. And the understanding is a record decision may come as soon as the December time frame. So they are looking at that document. They are looking at all the technical work. They are looking at the outreach and the comments made specific to the project. They will validate and confirm that the need for the project, the purpose and need, which is an authoritative document contained within the NEPA and the final EIS work, is appropriate, that we are meeting that. They will validate that the process vetted and selected the appropriate outcome. So all the alternatives we were playing, and I've shared with you this committee before, that we began with 70 different concepts. We moved to 12 alternatives, moved to 5, and then on to the one, the locally preferred alternative that has made its way into the final EIS document. Again, Federal Transit, Federal Highways scrutinizing that document. The importance and the significance of a record of decision is that it allows a project now to move forward in final design. to prepare itself to receive federal construction dollars as well. You have to cross that threshold known as the Record of Decision. I would be remiss to say that a project of this complexity and size, when a Record of Decision is delivered, there will likely be a lawsuit. It will be challenged in court. That's not unique to mega projects. I will say that the project team is confident of the work they've done on the technical side, confident of the aggressive outreach that we have made, and we should move forward. Obviously, we'll abide by whatever the courts rule, but that shouldn't come as a surprise if we are sued, if this Record of Decision is targeted. Additional conversations coming from Governor Kitzhaber and charging the Oregon State Treasurer with validating the financial plan, looking at the funding architecture that's built up around this. And Mr. Wheeler and some outside folks came in and provided scrutiny to the financial plan, and they identified some realities here. The modeling predicted a certain economic growth, and with that economic growth came a certain amount of mileage, of vehicle miles being traveled within that corridor. The reality is no one could anticipate the severity and the duration of the economic turn down. And what they said, listen, your math changed. You have to put in new variables. You start from a little further back than you'd anticipated. So we took that advice. We accommodated that. That's embedded in the final EIS document. We've recalibrated the numbers, so to speak. They've also said, listen, approach your funding plan in a very conservative way here, and we're going to give you a couple of pathways that we think can help. One is be very aggressive with the federal program known as TIFIA. It's the Transportation Infrastructure Finance and Innovative Act. What it is a loan program at the federal government at very low rates. They said that could stretch the toll revenue resources further and substantially reduce the burdens on the state of Oregon. So pursue that pathway. And I will tell you, even with the uncertainty that's playing itself out at the federal level with regard to funding, there is one common ground area between the House and the Senate, and that is the TIFIA program. They see it as a program that they want to move forward, and they actually want to invest exponentially more than they have in the past. So it is a pathway that is certainly viable as we look to the future. In addition, they made a recommendation you may want to pursue a policy conversation specific to pre-construction tolling, getting out in front. You're paying down the debt sooner, relieving some of the burdens. All that financial scrutiny was embedded in the financial plan, the financial component of the EIS document. And so we're moving forward. And again, there's another area where the federal lead agencies will apply scrutiny to that plan itself. I will tell you, significant conversations are playing themselves out at the federal level, not only with our delegation, but also with the administration. And the federal support from the administration via U.S. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood or his Deputy Secretary, Mr. Pokhari, or the Highway Administrator, Victor Mendez, or the Transit Administrator, Peter Rogoff. The Columbia River Crossing Project is identified as the prototype federal investment. Each of these gentlemen have said that. This is where the nation can bring a focus to the federal aid system. This project has national significance on the I-5 trade corridor. There's little doubt about that. The issue of the innovation of it being multimodal, of meeting many objectives in terms of the investment and how the project plays itself out. In terms of the opportunities that the project brings with regard to innovative finance and tolling, congestion pricing, and then again the multimodal nature of the project. The Secretary espouses this as the future project that all folks should look at in terms of the complexity and the comprehensive nature of a transportation investment. Those are his words. Those aren't mine. I couldn't write the words that the gentleman is saying better. So the acceptance and the support that we receive is at the highest levels with this administration. Now, again, that plays itself out with the $850 million specifically set aside for the New Starts the transit, the light rail component of this project, as well as other opportunities in terms of TIFIA. Again, they both, all these gentlemen have indicated that TIFIA is a viable pathway that you should take advantage of. They also said that you got to get your act together at the state of Oregon. You're going to have to show the skin in the game. There's a matching component and discipline that comes with the conversation. And I will tell you that component of the conversation will be laid out and present itself at the December 7th meeting of this select joint committee, this oversight committee on the Columbia River crossing, as we will move into, again, making sure everyone's comfortable with the conversation that culminates with the final EIS and the record of decision, and then moving into the financial conversation as we move down that critical path of final design to procurement to construction.
Senator Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Director Garrett, for the review and overview. Couple of questions.
Yes, sir.
Does the NEPA document in any way suggest an opportunity for phasing of the project? Is that contrary in any way to the EIS?
Not at all. I think what the NEPA project says, here's a locally preferable alternative, but then there's a cash flow conversation. This is the financing discussion here. So what can you build? Obviously, with there's some initial investments that maybe just due to cash flow realities, that here's the investment. Your overall goal is the locally preferred alternative, but a sequencing or a phasing conversation is a legitimate pathway and allowed within the document itself.
And final or next question would be, Mr. Chair, does the NEPA document EIS in any way limit the ability of the project sponsors to shift the risk of the project from the public sector to the private sector?
Chair Byer, Senator Starr, not at all. I think that is a pathway that will be explored. And again, from the beginning of this discussion, we saw different pathways in terms of delivering this project through a traditional mechanism or through some public-private partnership. That's still out there. That is no way negated.
And just to put an exclamation point on it, the department, and to your knowledge, the governor has not in any way, shape, or form closed the door in the conversation with a private sector partner in this project.
That's a truthful statement.
Thank you.
Just to be clear with everybody, the a lot of discussion during the session, a lot of new members, including myself, hadn't been involved in this, and there was a lot of fear that, well, gee, we don't know what's going on. What the leadership has done is created an oversight committee to follow it and provide that, so there's hands-on. But they've also asked the department to make periodic reports to the transportation committees on both sides, as well as to the Ways and Means Committee. So at some point, if we get to the point where we're asked to make a funding commitment or approval, we'll at least won't have the excuse that we haven't heard about it before. And as Matt was saying, at least in my view, in past experience with NEPA projects, this is really the start. You're a long ways from making a decision to construct something.
You kind of touched a sensitive button with me, and that is the skin in the game, and I don't want to go where Lee had already taken us, but we've always had a kind of a regionalization of how we spend ODOT money, and my fear is that bridge is going to be so expensive, and it just comes out of one region. How have you thought ahead as to how we can do that? So, I represent rural Oregon, and rural Oregon isn't penalized for the bridge crossing.
Chair Byer, Senator Gerard, it's a fair conversation, and we've thought about it long and hard. I would submit two arguments to the statement. The first is, this is a project that is of statewide and national significance. There's no question about it. If you look at this bridge influence area, you have two rivers, you have two rails, you have two interstates all pouring commerce into that area. We are an exporting state. I think one in five jobs are related to transportation and the exports that we do through it. The ability to make sure that that's functioning well, that has benefit not for the region but for the state of Oregon and not the nation. So again, I say that there is benefit both for the states of Oregon and Washington. There are benefits for the eastern Oregon grain growers, for the southern Oregon timber folks who are putting commerce and freight pouring into that bridge influence area, moving out of the Port of Portland to the various places. So again, I would argue that it is a statewide significance. The monies we're trying to attract, again, would come specifically to this project. Now again, the world has changed in terms of some of the discretionary type monies, but again, TIFIA has certain thresholds. There's only projects of, I think it's $100 million can compete. It may be 50, somewhere between 50 and $100 million. So you can see that we're going after those discretionary monies that really could only come to a project of this size and this significance. And I guess the other argument that I would make, Senator, is there's always a match required to receive federal dollars more times than not, especially in the highway portfolio. It's normally about an 80-20 split that changes with programs. But looking at this, if we put an amount of money on the table, the ability to leverage nearly $3 billion. And I'm setting aside all the benefits, the jobs that come with the project itself. But just on the financial side, the return on investment, to leverage nearly an additional $3 billion that would pour into this state and our sister state, I think that's a pretty fine return on investment. So I would argue both those sides when that question comes forward. And those are the types of probes and the thinking we've had specific to that question.
More? Anything else? Thanks very
Thank
much.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. Now we'll move back into the streamlining. Unless, Mr. Allen, you spent almost 4 years under a prior governor doing this.
I did. I asked someone the other day if I'm in purgatory. Just doomed to repeat the same loop over and over again.
Not to put you on the spot, but I was really hoping, and quite seriously, you did spend a lot of time, work very hard on it, and just wanted to, lessons learned, what can we do?
Sure, thank you very much. Chair Barr, members of the committee, my name is Patrick Allen. I'm the Deputy Administrator of the Building Codes Division at the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and from 2003 to 2007, I ran the Office of Regulatory Streamlining. I'll give you maybe about 5 or 7 minutes of kind of quick recap of what that office did over that time that I was involved with it, and some lessons learned, as Chair Barr suggests. Office was created by Governor Kulongoski's very first executive order, where he told state agencies, among other things, to go look at business regulations and figure out ways to make them cheaper, faster, simpler, easier to understand, easier to comply with without lowering standards for protecting consumers, workers, public health, safety, and the environment. We did a number of sort of major pieces of work during that initiative. We did a business climate survey around the state early on to try to get at the level of, you know, we can hear easily, regulations are killing me. What do you mean by that? What kinds of things are the issues? Hold on to this thought, because it'll be important again at the end. Number two, the top two things that we heard in that survey were repeal the Endangered Species Act and get rid of the minimum wage. Would be the best streamlining things that that we could do according to those survey respondents. And again, I want to come back to that. We talked about customer service. So part of the executive order directed agencies to look at the people they regulate, businesses they regulate, as customers, not as their only customers or not solely as customers, but have that be an element of how they deal with them and begin doing things like surveying them for customer satisfaction and coming up with customer service improvement plans and those kinds of things. First and foremost, we did a set of projects. We did over 300 single agency and multi-agency projects to go and make individual regulatory processes work better. And we actually tracked performance results on those projects in terms of pages of paper saved, hours of time by people regulated saved, dollars that were saved in regulatory compliance, and it was hundreds of thousands of sheets of paper and millions of dollars and thousands of hours that those projects totaled up. We also worked on legislation. We had, over the course of the three sessions that I was involved, several dozen bills that we brought to the legislature to streamline regulations, and those were, in the main, fairly mundane kinds of things like authorizing agencies to, instead of having every license renew on the same date, so they had a big wave of people all trying to renew their licenses at the same time, allow them to spread them out over the course of the year. Believe it or not, that was statutory stuff often. Things like allowing for electronic signatures instead of live signatures, or removing notary requirements when they really weren't valuable. Those kinds of things that were statutory barriers to being able to simplify regulations. We also played defense. on legislation. I came in and testified. Well, I participated, first of all, in the governor's office's review of agency concepts, and we spiked quite a few that we believe the agencies didn't make the case of why some higher or more complicated level of regulation was justified in terms of its public protection. I also came in and testified against stakeholder bills that that did the same thing. The one that most notably sticks out in my mind is there was a proposal to license landscape maintenance contractors. Those are people who cut grass. We wanted a couple of you were in the committees that dealt with that. I can see smiles. I believe the legislative concept actually said something like to prevent things like inappropriate fertilization. And I'm not making that up. That was actually part of the justification for why we needed to license guys who cut grass. And we were able to say, you know, really there's not enough of something here that requires licensing and bonding and continuing education and all those sorts of things. What I want to do, though, is that's kind of the rundown of some of the things we did. I want to tell you two stories about regulation that illustrate, I think, best the lessons that we learned. The first story, call I got from a guy, I think, in Hermiston, who ran what I came to understand was the most regulated business in the entire state of Oregon, which is the local convenience store. If you run a convenience store and you sell gas and beer and wine and cigarettes and have a deli counter and sell packaged food and Advil and that kind of stuff, you have something over a dozen state agencies that care about what you do. Department of Environmental Quality registers your underground storage tank to make sure we don't spend a bazillion dollars 30 years from now cleaning up a bunch of gasoline spills. Liquor Control Commission licenses you to sell the beer and wine. The state police make sure that you're not selling cigarettes to minors. Department of Agriculture checks the safety of your deli counter to make sure the mojos and corn dogs don't kill people quickly. The pharmacy board licenses your sales of non-prescription pharmaceuticals and on and on and on. And the 300 projects kind of comes back into play here because we did 300 things in that initiative to make sort of each of those 14 things work pretty well. And if you go and you ask a business person, like I did with this guy in Hermiston, well, you know, are there things about each of those individual things that are really a problem or a big breakdown? And it wasn't so much that any of those were operated particularly badly or disjointed or anything else. It was that there were 14 of them. And the fact is, if what he's saying is there's always somebody here from the government to look at my books or inspect my store or do something, he's right. And that's not sort of a paperwork issue or a, you know, could we coordinate better issue. It's there's a lot of stuff that we have chosen to hold people accountable for, and it piles up and piles up and piles up. And so to really get to that, you actually have to ask substantive questions like, now that two-thirds of all the gas stations in the state are gone and we've replaced all the underground storage tanks and their modern systems and insurance companies watch this stuff like a hawk, do we need that same kind of regulation? I don't know. I just posit the question. Do we need, my own division regulates the CO2 tanks that run the soda fountain. We used to actually go and inspect them. We've actually gotten rid of that. But right now we make sure that they meet code and we license them to begin with. Do we need to do that? It's actually kind of weeding through those 14 different things to figure out, do you really need all of that stuff? And instead of looking just at the value of each individual thing, looking at the value of the whole collection of it against what you get for it. Second story is about independent contractors. If you deal with a small business person, you'll likely hear about this issue of, gosh, there are a million different definitions of what's an independent contractor. And honestly, between the federal and state government and various state agencies, the answer is it depends who's asking and why. And you have launched task forces to go fix that problem. There have been all kinds of efforts to try to figure out why we have all these different definitions. And they seem to come from a premise that I think is wrong, which is each of those definitions was created by some bureaucrat in a windowless room who wasn't consulting the next bureaucrat in the next windowless room over, and they got definitions that conflict. That's actually not the case. If you're talking about an independent contractor for workers' comp, the public policy principle is when people are injured on the job, they should get medical care, and if they can't work, they should be compensated for that. And we want, as a matter of public policy, we want as many people protected that way as possible. That argues for a very narrow definition of an independent contractor. On the other hand, we've set public policy that says, in terms of tax withholding, we want to make sure that we want to minimize the number of people who have to have withholding and make it easy to have someone be a contractor so we don't have to withhold from what we pay them. Well, those are two actually conflicting policy goals. And it's not some matter of if only we wrote smarter rules, we could fix that. There's actually a policy choice that you got to make to say, we're going to change one of those so that we can line them up. Otherwise, we're going to have different definitions as we do today. And I guess that's really kind of the takeaway that I would leave you is, we can go out and send agencies off to do a bunch of those, 300 or 3,000 more individual projects, which in the main, agencies tend to do this kind of stuff on our own. It's in our own interest to operate things more efficiently, more effectively, smarter. We can start cataloging that stuff again. I don't think people will necessarily come and tell you, wow, everything's better because of those, unless we're able to really look at some of these underlying policy conflicts and really figure out how we want to resolve them. With that, I'd be happy to answer questions you might have.
Very, very bright note. Questions about Senator?
Thank you. Actually, you started off with something that I think is probably a lot more serious than what people realize, and that is if you were to ask people in the state the two biggest problems, land use and Endangered Species Act, and land use shouldn't be taken off the table, and I think that in my city alone, there are people that just go out and they try to stop all development. We call them the quack attack. And they'll use every means. And we seem to tip the table to that sort of nonconformity. And I really think that if the governor wants to streamline things and make the state wide open for business, you have to tackle the land use issue. ESA, yeah, it's a federal issue. But if we had a governor that would stand up and say, hey, the ESA started trying to save the bald eagle and whales. We are down to blue butterflies that are the size of my little finger. I mean, it keeps getting more and more constricted. And so we can definitely have some, we could have an input. The legislature could send a memo to Congress saying this needs to be reviewed. Those two things absolutely have to be on the table.
Yeah, Chair Byer, Senator Drott, I didn't touch on, I guess, probably one other big lesson that the land use issue gets to, which is if you scratch a state regulatory itch, you often find a problem that actually is either a local problem or most often an interrelationship between local government and state government, a local agency implementing a state law or something like that. I think you're right. But again, it's not a matter of if only the bureaucrats were more creative, we could go fix that. It really, it comes to substantive policy choice. That need to get made to get at some of those issues.
I think you were back at his first one to the big two, eliminate the endangered species, huh?
Yeah.
and the minimum wage was the...
Oh, the minimum wage, sorry.
Until
that, I don't have to
with you. Thanks, Pat.
Thanks.
Senator Johnson, I see you're in the audience. Would you... I'm assuming you want to address the potential legislation?
I do, Mr. Chair, but your staff has said you want to finish this hearing, and we're perfectly happy to wait until it's sequenced properly.
Are you sure?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Then, with that, we would invite up the next three, Mr. Ledger, Mr. Deckert, and Mr. Rogers.
Right.
Now, your three organizations just held a big hoo-ha on regulatory reform, so I'm sure that you have all kinds of suggestions for us. That's a setup.
Yeah. I think some people may need to leave before me.
Okay.
I have a 3:30, Senator Byers, so, and I can do it in a minute. So I'll just make my one-minute testimony and department Chair Byer, Vice Chair Atkinson, and members of the Senate Business Committee. It's a pleasure to be before you today, Ryan Deckert with the Oregon Business Association. We generally have two main thoughts. One is, don't throw everything out that's actually been effective in the regulatory framework, and we look at the Renewable Portfolio Standard as a good example that has generated $5.9 billion in new investment that could fall under the guise of regulatory, but it's generated real economic investment and jobs in the state of Oregon since its inception. Secondly, to meet the task at hand that you called out, Mr. Chair, of specificity, so four ideas that the Oregon legislature could take up, and they're specific, either executive orders or statutory. What we have at least found in talking to private businesses is that there's two main issues, time and certainty. And I would categorize a third that is attitudinal. So the four fall under that rubric of speed, of time, certainty, and attitudinal. One is set timeline and limit, either statutory or executive order, for agency approval. By doing that, what you're saying to agencies is you're working on a timeline here to get to an answer. Second one would be to do something like the state of Washington, which is adopt a hiatus on new regulation. And so they chose 9 months. They did it by executive order. You could do it statutory. But what it really told agencies and private business in the state was, we understand we're in an economically difficult time. We exempt out food and health standards and environmental, but agencies, this is not a time to go out and think about new regulations that you would put on business at this time. Third is set some sort of state standard for decision making. What we found is there's one county in particular that just tends to be much harder, longer, and more difficult. It's our most populated county, and so there's more economic activity happening there. I reside close, so not picking on particular, well, we are in this case actually picking on one county, but that it tends to be, and so by setting some sort of state standard, it comes up over and over, is that we have one jurisdiction in particular that's just very difficult and time-consuming and seems to have, so by having some sort of state standard, that would be really helpful.
Can you elaborate on that?
That would be necessary.
What would that look like?
In terms of speed, the state obviously has statutory authority to come to be able to say certain decisions will be made in a certain period of time. Doesn't dictate what the decision would be, but that we will make certain planning and decisions within a certain framework of time.
Are you talking mainly about land use?
Yeah, it's planning and it's.
Because we do for long-standing decision. 120-day standard on decisions on land use.
Yeah, and you know, John,
unless it's waived,
Chandler's going to talk in a moment. But I mean, we mostly get it from construction, and we mostly get it from folks that are trying to get.
Well, we'll give John a chance to address that when he comes up. Then, okay.
And so the fourth, trying to get it in 2 minutes, is some sort of favorable towards traded sector, because traded sector is obviously the one that grows income, gets us closer to the national average in terms of per capita income. And so we did some, or the state did some fast tracking in terms of industrial land and traded sector siting. And that would be the other one that the legislature could do statutorily to be able to say, if you meet the traded sector, which is in statute definition, and you're going to locate new jobs to the state of Oregon, we would fast track you in terms of siting decisions.
Questions?
Ryan? Sorry. You kind of danced around one of my chief issues, and that's administrative rule. I mean, we pass 1,000 laws here on average, probably every session. 12,000 administrative rules go into effect. We are one of the few states that don't have any administrative rule curtailment. Would you like to weigh in on that, or do you not want to take a position on that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Girard, we would be interested in anything that would be fit into that attitudinal. And so some of what Washington accomplished, we thought was more less on actual, that it sent a message to folks that are adopting administrative rules and to thinking of other possible regulations from the elected leadership of the state, that this is not what we want you to be working on at this point. That is not what we charge you with. And so how's that for not
looking at that dance? That was a good dance, but it was nice.
So you're looking at something that just conceptually would say, for example, if we were to do it in February, notwithstanding the Administrative Procedures Act, departments shall not adopt any administrative rules affecting businesses unless it creates a public health or safety?
Well, Mr. Chair, when we talked, we liked the way that Governor Greg Warr, when she did it by executive order about a year ago, but she said to her state agencies, now you could obviously do it either by executive order or statute, that we would not, and she had a couple of areas of exemption like food safety, but that we are not entertaining new regulations for this set time period. In talking to some peers in the state of Washington, several of our businesses do business in both states. They said the big accomplishment there was it told them for 9 months, but it was also attitudinal, that we're not going to get anything. That we, and that's the certainty test, we are, and the state understands our condition. We're here to grow jobs and try to grow, and the state understands that. And so we think that was the success of that executive order.
Mr. Chair, legislation was introduced this year that didn't move on that specific idea.
Further, Mr. Chair, it boils down to a conflict between the legislative branch and the executive branch. It actually would require a constitutional amendment to get proper oversight. But that's something that we could send to the voters very easily and ask them to do that.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Deckard. We'll let you go and be only a little late to your next appointment.
Thanks.
Mr. Ledger.
I'll start off with the issue of administrative rule review. Many states have let me tell you, back up a little bit. And most of you know me. I have actually been through a reasonably successful streamlining project when I was running air programs under Cecil Andrus in Idaho, and then ran cleanup programs and was deputy director. And we looked at it extensively when I was an adjunct professor at Boise State teaching government regulation. And I've been here working with regulations for 15 years. And one of the things I'll just start off on is the issue of legislative veto. And many states have the idea of a legislative veto is the legislature has some way to stop or alter a rule because that lawmaking authority has been delegated to a body that's appointed by the governor. And those rules have the effect of law, and you can go to prison for violating those rules. And the strength of legislative review of rules varies from nothing to extraordinarily strong. When I left Idaho, every legislative rule sunsetted each July 1 and only went on if it was allowed to by a resolution. It was not subject to the governor's veto. Plus, the legislative body could change the rule by resolution. And I had to go in front of those committees each year and make a pitch for our rules. Now, I've heard many people say that was unconstitutional, and it was just a comment really on the capability of the state Supreme Court, that was allowed to go forth. You know. And in some states, the legislature can do it essentially by a recommendation, which you could do. The legislature here could look at any legislative rule it wished to, hold a hearing on it, and vote whether they objected to the rule or not. Agencies, believe me, listen to that. Any agency would. You have to be put in a position where you're not swamped by legislative rules, which is a pretty brutal thing just to look at. In some states, it's heavily contested. When Governor Blagojevich was deposed, one of the reasons that the legislature did it was they said that he bypassed the rule review committee, which he said was unconstitutional. And so they range all over. And there are variations that can be done without constitutional amendments. Support for it varies depending on, frankly, what the committee looks like, where the rules are going to go in front of. And you may have a business community that would be supportive of that or not, depending on the makeup of the committee that was going in front of. It becomes a political question. Just quickly, what you heard earlier was kind of your dilemma, which is this range of rules. You heard a horizontal scope of rules, which was you have a gas station and you're subject to fire code, a whole bunch of things. And then you have a vertical range of rules. I primarily work with industrial sources. So an industrial source will have one permit, and in that permit there will be rules that simply reference federal regulations. That's it. There'll be rules that were adopted by the state because the federal government said you had to. There'll be rules that are adopted by rules in that permit, piece in the permit, that just had to be done by the state where the Fed said they were adequate and blessed. In some cases, they were adopted by rules that the federal government took the state rules and actually promulgated them in their federal register. So even if you change them, the source is subject to federal enforcement on them. There'll be pieces in that permit that come from rules that were pure policy. by policy documents that are done by a company. There'll be pieces in that permit that are done because the permit writer has great discretion on what he puts in that permit. And there'll be pieces in that permit that were in there because it was part of a community involvement, a negotiation. So you have this big structure vertically and horizontally. So when you say, I want to know what's bothering you about regulatory things, you get this buckshot back at you that you can't sort out. So I kind of think of this as dividing it into three buckets that you can deal with. And I'll tell you the one that I think kind of works better than the others. The first bucket I would call kind of the structural bucket. And that is, how is government set up? You have a DEQ, you have an ag, you have an EPA, and you can move those around, and that's usually one of the first things people want to do is kind of reorganize, because it's the easiest. I was involved in a little bit of that. I don't think it pays off a lot. The second one is what I would call the legal, and that is the rules and regulations and the laws themselves. I think that's about 20% of the problem, the actual rules and regulations. There are lots that we would like to change. And you've done pretty well on those. Because when you think about it, you can divide those into two pieces. One are specific things, which you did, for instance, with the linear permitting. Regulation reform. You know, the linear permitting bill is specific. You did one that allowed better access to highways from grocery stores and stuff. That was a specific reform. And then there are reforms I would call systemic reforms, and those would be things like legislative review, administrative procedures, and you can do those short or long term. They tend to be harder to do, and they have a broader scope. The third bucket, which you heard allude talk about, was essentially what I call the cultural bucket. And that is, how do agency staff, and I was one for a long time, deal with the people they regulate or the public? And this is the area where it could be most productive and is also most difficult, because people come to work for agencies for different reasons. People go to work for the Department of Agriculture because they like agriculture and they'll advocate for it. People go to work for the DEQ and they do a good job, but they don't go there because they want to issue a lot of permits. They do there because they want to protect the environment, and that's the culture of the agency, which is appropriate. So you deal with how do you, and that is where most of the problems arise, is with endless reiteration of permit reviews, especially on the industrial side. So you have to deal with that if you're going to actually do something really constructive. When I was in Idaho, we had, and this is a caution and also some hope. When I was in Idaho, we had a backlog of about 100 air permits. So people just weren't building because they couldn't get an air permit from it. It was just too long. It took forever to get one. And we sat down, and there was some legislation that was needed, not a lot, and you already have it. But what you have to do is build the fix if you really want to change how these things work from the bottom up. That is the agency culture up. And you cannot impose that from the top effectively. I was a bureaucrat for 15 years, and I was good at it. You have to have it come up from the bottom. And what we did in that case was we stopped issuing permits for about 2 weeks. We sent everybody a letter saying, you're not going to get a permit. We're going to sit down and figure out how to fix the backlog. And we put everybody in a room, just like you would in a company, and say, you need to build something better. You put your staff on it. You don't threaten them, and you say, how do you do it? And you let them rebuild, do the analysis, and rebuild the procedure. And we came up with a system of triaging permits. We came up with a system where we could take some pieces out and have a third party, a consultant, work on it. And we worked through that backlog very quickly, and we streamlined the process dramatically. But it has to come from the staff up, and that is a managerial issue. What did not work very well, frankly, was reorganization. You know, we reorganized, so we had a permitting bureau, essentially, and that did not work well. So we've looked at this a lot. There are a lot of things you can do, and I think you'll hear more about legislative issues. But the core of this, if you really want to change it, it has to be managerial and has to enable the staff to do it so they will buy into it. That Otherwise, it just doesn't work. It just, and everybody gets frustrated, and it goes forever. We'd be happy to help any way we can, but it can be done, but there's no magic wand. One last thing is, a lot of agencies are really controlled by the commissions, not the governor indirectly, but the commissions. So one of the things you always need to be aware of is how, when people go through the confirmation process, that you make sure that this is tops on their order of business for them to do when they oversee an agency, is make it responsive. So that's all I have. It probably took longer than I should have, and I'm sorry if I made you late, Jeremy.
Oh, no, I'm actually not leaving anymore.
Jeremy, please.
Okay.
Thank you, Vice Chair Atkinson, and the committee members of the committee. My name is Jeremy Rogers. I'm with the Oregon Business Council. And and you heard this mentioned earlier, we included last year in the Oregon Business Plan a recommendations to simplify and streamline regulatory and permitting processes, and we included eight recommendations at the time, and let me just read those to you quickly, and then I'll reflect on some of them. The first was what we heard Pat doing today, which is reviewing the work that was done under the Kulongoski administration around streamlining to figure out where it worked well, where it didn't, and what lessons could be learned from that. The second was to, when considering new regulations, to include job creation, assessment of job creation impacts. The third was to make reforms to appeals processes to prevent endless and frivolous appeals. The fourth was to establish time requirements for agencies to act on permits, enforcement actions, and development of new regulations. The fifth was to separate permits from policy functions and regulatory agencies and to move towards a one-stop efficient natural resource permit process. The sixth was requiring agency rules to meet strict need standards and robust cost of compliance evaluation. And then the last two were to consider these initiatives when we're setting our budgets for agencies, and finally to try to figure out how to coordinate this work at a regional and local level. This was a pretty high-level list. We appreciate that the governor's office has been, you know, looking at this list when they're doing their work, and I think that there's progress that can be made on these issues. But I also have had many conversations since we built this original list, and I think what we've heard from previous speakers is important. And John, I think John's structure of the three buckets, where the real problems lie, structural problems, legal problems, and cultural problems, is very accurate. And the stuff on this list, I think, can be helpful, but I also would caution, you know, some of these things already exist. We have regulations that require certain things, but that doesn't necessarily fix the problem. We have legislation, it doesn't always fix the problem. The cultural issues, I would agree with John that if you really wanted to do a fundamental redesign process on a particular regulation, you would want to really figure out a few areas to focus on and try to do a bottom-up process to get at that. And from our perspective and our interest in this topic, we're really talking about industrial projects and talking about infrastructure projects. We're very focused on traded sector, and while there's a lot of validity to taking on issues for commercial and other small business applications, we're very interested in those. And I would suggest that one approach would be to and I think the business community needs to do a better job of communicating and doing our own homework to let you know where to focus. But we picked three or four areas where we really think we could get better environmental outcomes at a lower time or lower cost, that we do a deep dive process to redesign the permitting around those activities. And I don't think it's going to come from a specific piece of legislation. It's really going to have to involve people who know what they're doing and get people to buy in. So I'm a big fan of what John said. Now, I would say on a couple specific things, one thing that we hear a lot about very particularly is the transportation planning rule. And there is a effort underway right now.
Senator Atkinson,
can either of you give me one specific
Senator Atkins, specific what?
One specific, any specific rule that you would specifically change? Any specific one singular laser beam?
Yeah, well, I was about change? To say, Senator Atkinson, was the transportation planning rule is a great example of something.
No, I don't want a great example. I don't want a great example. I know plenty of examples and task forces and collaborative things. I want one specific legislative proposal, one specific laser beam legislative proposal. Can you give me one? Just one.
I'll give you one. I think you could do a lot that would help if you actually required an economic impact analysis of rules and you funded a body to do it. It's in the law now. The agencies do it themselves. And a lot of states have this. And where the agencies do them themselves, they are not well done across the board. Where they kind of are well done is when you have a body that's independent of the agency that has the people on board that can actually look at something and say, this is what the economic impact of this rule is going to be, and people have confidence in what that answer is. Because right now, we're doing rulemaking blind on economic impact. Thank That's you, one thing that would make a huge difference.
Wanted to know one.
John, do you have examples of states that do that?
I'm sure I can find you one, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. That'd be helpful. I'm sorry, we cut you off on the
topic. Oh, no, it's fine. What I was going to say is that the this committee last year reviewed legislation and passed legislation around the transportation planning rule, and there's a process going on right now to make that rule more accommodative to economic development. And I think that one very specific thing that could be done is to that this committee needs to evaluate whether that rulemaking process has worked, and if not, to pass additional legislation that would make that rule more accommodative to economic development. I'd be happy to provide some ideas about how to do that.
I think we suggested to them that that was the case.
Yeah.
Find out on December 4th.
Absolutely. The other thing I'd like to say is that I think we started last year with a very good model with Senate Bill 766 that this committee worked very hard on, and I think that accomplished a few goals around industrial permitting. One is that it created a streamlined appeals process. Two is that it got started to deal with the issue of local regulations that might be more restrictive or costly or unnecessary given what we already have on state and federal regulations. And it created a mechanism for agencies to move quickly and to collaborate. And so I think one important thing is to try to execute that process effectively and figure out how we can build off of that. I think it was an important piece of legislation, and it got at some important aspects of the list that I had read off. So
there are lots of things you could do. I mean, you could do something that would say, and these go back to fights we've had, that where a numerical standard exists, the state rule cannot be more stringent than that required by the federal government, where a numerical standard exists without legislative approval. You could do that.
Another opportunity, I think, would be to create a some sort of ombudsman. If to the degree that, and for a lot of people, the problem is there are many agencies involved, many permits involved. This would be less around potentially around the industrial projects, but if you're looking at something for a smaller business, as Pat mentioned, the a convenience store that's it's got 14 different is dealing with 14 different agencies. To have a person who's kind of on the side of the permit applicant and an advocate for them in the process would be something that I think would be very helpful for, particularly for smaller companies that don't have the staff and the expertise to be dealing with all the regulatory requirements.
The issue of timeliness and timelines is difficult because I just haven't done that myself. You can put a lot of timelines in the law and rules, and you just what happens is you come bump it up against the deadline on the timeline, and the source is faced with either getting the permit denied or having it kicked back through the timeline again. So I don't know if those are
appreciate
that valid.
John, now you too, are starting to get the specifics that would be helpful.
You could.
To us as legislators rather than a generalities.
Right.
So it would be nice to get that kind of thing, suggestions in writing. And, oh, by the way, we have to have the request in by December 4th, 5th, if you want it done in February. Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jeremy, you mentioned number 5, I think, on your list was something about separating permits from public policy goals.
From policy functions.
From policy functions. Could you elaborate on that a little bit more?
Yeah, and I think a lot of agencies already are doing this. But the idea would be that the kind of rulemaking function and the permitting function be separated, and it kind of gets towards the idea of what I was talking about with an ombudsman, where you actually are dealing with somebody who is really focused on delivering the permit rather than on developing the regulations. I think most agencies, and I've talked to some agencies about this, including Dick Peterson, and I think a lot of agencies are already moving towards that or already doing that. So,
Senator.
Oh, thank you. I was going to bring this up a little later, but I did a fairly large development, and I think the most frustrating thing I experienced was the feds and the state couldn't agree. The state lands and Corps of Army engineers couldn't agree what was wetlands. The Fish and Wildlife couldn't agree what was a fish-bearing stream and what wasn't. Have you looked into those areas where there's overlap, and maybe as a legislature we could say that if there is overlap, that the feds take priority, and that would single it out as to who has the authority to make a determination. We waited months, and we couldn't care less what the determination was. We just couldn't get one.
You could certainly look at where there are ambiguities in delegation would be one approach.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anything else, gentlemen?
Not that wouldn't get people upset.
Well, what the heck?
Actually, I'll throw one out there. Actually, I think this is key, and I hear this quite a bit. I think it's important to try to identify where there are major cogs in the wheel at an agency. I'm talking about staff. I think that, as John said, most folks working in our agencies are doing an excellent job, and they're. But I think there are probably a few people that aren't or are doing everything in their power to slow things down. And I think putting that on the table, being upfront about it, and having a real conversation about if the problem is a person, dealing with it at a personal level rather than trying to create a new policy to address the problem.
I appreciate that, but I think that's an executive function.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
John, make people upset. It's okay. I'm not crabby.
Well, one thing
let me finish. I'm very frustrated.
Yes.
Because all we do is talk in generalities, and we talk about collaborating and studying and doing all this stuff.
And
nothing ever happens.
And the reason
Bring the specifics to us. We're a split. The Democrats run the Senate. That's cool. Whatever. Mm-hmm. Let us beat each other up. That's what we're elected to do. Bring us the ideas. We will disagree. The task force doesn't have to all fall in love and hold hands before they make a decision.
I think
that's not leadership, John. That's pacifying.
Well, I would never pacify.
Leadership is bringing tough issues.
But the reason, and I understand why you're frustrated.
I'm beyond frustrated.
Because as a legislator, just having done this for many years, as a legislator, you're used to seeing problems and fixing them by legislation, because that's what you do for a living, and you're all very good at it. But some things, like in this case, some pieces of it can be fixed by legislation, and you'll hear some more. I'm sure you'll hear about state preemption, all kinds of things. But the bulk of the problem is when somebody goes to get a permit, and the modeler goes, okay, I looked at your modeling results that your consultant gave me, and we're not going to use we don't want to use CalPUF model. We want to use such and such and such. So you run the model again, another $50,000 or whatever, and you run the model again. Because, well, that's the model doesn't have proper resolution, and we want you to include area sources in this area all around it. So there you run it again for that. It starts to drive up the cost. And then maybe, well, that's not a big enough area, and we want you to make, allowances for a change in the baseline of emission data. So you run, that's all within the discretion of the permit writer. And that's not some, and that can drag it out for, you know, 4 or 5 months, or the permit starts to get renewed, it starts to get kicked into a broader than regulatory process and becomes this big kind of communal event, and which scares businesses to death. But that's not something you can fix. It is an executive branch thing. We can only bring you so much.
Okay, I've got some other people. Thank you very much. And Mr. Chandler, Meekins, and Anstrom. All right, take your chance.
Take your money and you take your chances. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here with Mr. Gallagher in absentia. What I'm handing around here is some work that Tom and I came up with. Tom did the scrivening. The good ideas are mine. The typos are Tom's, of course. And when staff contacted us to tell us we were invited testimony to come talk about regulatory reform, I tried to count up how many times over my career lobbying we've had this discussion, and I bailed out at about 346. The only consolation I had was that at least we're not doing secondary lands in this discussion. And after listening to Mr. Allen, I had to add independent contractor to that list of insolvable problems. I delighted you're having this discussion, but allow me, before I get to the substance of my remarks, to say that if there's a substantive effort going forward, I will give you every ounce of time and energy I have to accomplish it. If we're going to talk, I'm busy that day, oddly enough. This is very hard. The reason it hasn't happened before is it is very hard. It is very controversial. To fix regulations, you have to do, as Mr. Ledger pointed out, you've got these various buckets, and you have to dig into those buckets, and when you do that, you aggravate people, and you aggravate vested interests, and you aggravate the citizenry, most of whom, by the way, as you all know, does not distinguish between what the city does and what the county does and what the state does and what the feds do and what the Eurozone does. They don't care. It's government. And so there's a real morass of misunderstanding and frustration out there in the general public and of the advocates on in favor of increased regulation. And my caution to you is, go forward, yes, let's by all means do it, but be aware that the reason that you're having this conversation, and Senator Atkins, I share your frustration, the reason we're still having the discussion is it is difficult, and the path really isn't all that simple. I've got some ideas, we'll talk about them. These ideas aren't law because, oddly enough, some people don't agree with these ideas, and in previous sessions when we raised them, we didn't have the votes to move them forward. Maybe they're bad ideas. That's another possibility, although it's unlikely, frankly, since I was associated with them. But I remember a conversation. The last time we did a real deep dive in this swamp, the issue of water permits. Governor Kulongoski administration, I think it might have been the effort that Mr. Allen was referring to. And we used water permits because that was kind of the state-level equivalent of Mr. Allen's convenience store, where you have 6 or 7 or 8, depending on the type of project you're talking about, different state agencies that have some piece of a project involving water permitting. And by the time you get the 8th one straightened out, the first one's off the bus again, and you have to go start through the process. Very, very difficult. And I met with the governor in his office, and I was pitching hard on agency restructuring and reform. And what he told me is the politics of this, as you know, are turbulent. And this is only a slight summarization of his comments. And I'm not mad at him at all. I think he made a good point. It simply wasn't the one I wanted to make. He says, Chandler, every one of those agencies has a board or a commission. Every one of those boards or commissions has work groups, task forces, and subcommittees. Every one of those work groups, task forces, and subcommittees has constituents on it, and interest groups on it, and advocates on it, and they have stakeholders. Why on earth do I want to go irritate, and this is my gloss, not his, the left-handed fly fishermen who have somebody on some subcommittee at ODF&W and are going to go ballistic if I fiddle with it? That's extraordinarily good political analysis, and that's part of the reason that you've stalled out, you legislatively, not you individually, have stalled out on this issue. So with that background noise, there's two other points I'll make. One is you can do substantive reforms where you look at a particular set of rules topic by topic and say we are going to change them, eradicate them, amend them, what have you. That's a whole different set of difficulty. Then you have some procedural fixes, which is what I'm going to talk about today. If and when you want to discuss the transportation planning rule, I'll be more than happy to, because I'll cheerfully admit I'm barely rational on that topic, but I do have some definite ideas about what ought to be done with it. Would start with taking it behind the barn and whacking it repeatedly on the head. Looking at the paper I brought you, and this hopefully will address some of your requests for specificity, Senator Atkinson, you can do what was already mentioned, a cost-benefit analysis. I would apply the legislature's actions to this as well. There were a couple of bills last session that got no traction that would have taken a look at the job impacts of bills that were being passed. And I summarize the discussion there. Everything that has a spending impact goes down to the Ways and Means hallway, puddles up, and theoretically triage is done at some point where we look at this amount of spending versus that amount of spending and how, which is more important if you only have a finite amount of resources. There is no such analysis for regulations or statutes in that case that might affect the ability of Oregon to create jobs. Same thing at the agency level. We passed out of mighty striving about 1991, I believe, a requirement that all state agencies adopt a housing cost impact statement when they adopt a rule, and meaning no disrespect to the state agencies, but I have no idea how many thousands of rules have been adopted since that time, apparently not a one of which had anything, any impact on the price of housing. It becomes a paper exercise. It's one more thing for the agency to do. The third party analysis that I believe Mr. Ledger mentioned makes some sense, but at the very least to try to say, before you regulate, look if there is a what is it you're trying to accomplish, and is this the least effective, least intrusive way to accomplish that objective? Instead of just regulating because there's an interesting idea or somebody went to a conference or because there's some vague reference in the federal law, is this the best way to do it? Second point. And this one I'm frankly not sure I like this one, but I'm going to offer it out there anyway because it would at least start a good discussion. Right now, one of the things that plagues businesses, and as already been mentioned, and you all know this, the biggest thing that aggravates the business community, speaking as a lobbyist for at least a subset of it, is the time, the uncertainty. A fast yes is what we want. If we can't get a fast yes, we want a fast no. What kills this, it kills a project, it kills the financing, it stalls your options, it just makes things miserable, is when it takes forever to get an answer of any sort. One idea we have is the regulatory agency, subject to the APA guidelines about fraud and undue influence and whatnot, is a decision maker, period. So you get a shot. You get an appeal to the agency's director, perhaps, and then you're done. You don't go to court. You don't go off to the Court of Appeals, Supreme Court, Circuit Court. You simply take your answer and go home. Now, in a lot of cases, that'll derail projects, which, frankly, that's the part I'm not sure I like. On the other hand, an expeditious no is better than a 6 or 8 or 10 year slog through the court system. Point three, and this one is my personal favorite, pick a level of government that's going to do a regulation. If it's appropriate for state regulation, then the cities and counties cannot. If it's appropriate for local regulation, then the state cannot. If the feds have a better rule on the books than what we do, then the feds ought to take it and run with it. But we should not pile up, and water permitting is probably the leading example of this, the one I'm most familiar with, but I'm sure there's multitudes out there in other agencies I simply don't work with, where you have a federal Clean Water Act, then you have a state interpretation of the Clean Water Act, and then you have city by city, county by county, water purveyor by water purveyor interpretations of those things and different glosses and different expansions. Pick. And there's a piece of legislation for you, Senator. Pick one level for his topic, and whichever one it is. Frankly, I don't care. I'll reserve the right to come here and argue with you as an individual case arises as to which one might be the best one. But so not make the process go through these different iterations, because when you do that, you've got to comply with each level's requirements, and if they're slightly different than some lawyer somewhere, and I'm a recovering lawyer and used to be pretty good at this sort of thing, will find a reason why that ought to be appealed. One time, one agency, one level. Makes it done. That's for new regulations. For existing regulations, there's a couple things we think you could do to clean up the existing statutes. And one of the things I think the legislature collectively doesn't do is recognize the professionalism of your agencies. I mean, we're up here talking about rules and regulatory reform as though there's a bunch of bad guys out there that just need to be set down and disciplined. They're professionals. We don't treat them as professionals in the budgetary process, and I realize this isn't Ways and Means, but we don't let them manage to within a budget and keep the money and reapply it within the agency. We take it and give it someplace else. We don't allow our agency directors to do the job we hired them for. They're paid pretty well. They're all smart people. And we don't treat the staff as professionals in helping solve this problem. So one idea we had was you have the agencies and you pick a few. I've got my favorites, but they're obviously parochial. They're the ones that I work with. There's others out there that I don't work with. But you pick four or five agencies and you tell them, form an advisory committee of the regulated community, your stakeholders, the interest groups that play in that sandbox, and you go figure out, look at your existing rules and see if you can, like I mentioned earlier, can you do the same outcome, can you achieve the same regulatory objective in at least a less burdensome fashion? And let the agencies help look at their own work. They know, if you ask them nicely and they feel safe in giving you an answer, they know what rules they're doing that are silly. We simply haven't, and I think in a lot of cases, we simply haven't created the environment where they can have that conversation without fear of reprisal and getting slapped around. And then if that work group identifies particular rules that are just specifically costly and burdensome and horrible, then you look specifically at those and try to come up with a better way, to a better process for achieving the outcomes. Also in that same level, and this goes back to my water example I started with, eliminate agency duplication. We have a lot of agencies doing work that overlaps. We need to stop doing that. There's a perfectly good financial reason to quit doing that right now because the state, unless things have improved since the paper came out this morning, we don't have any money. And so if we can figure out a way to save some money by not having two or three agencies do the same stuff, that makes a lot of sense. But also from a business standpoint, then you know this is the agency I talked to about this topic. I don't have to talk to this other agency. It also allows, in keeping with what Michael Jordan is trying to do at Governor Kitzhaber's instigation, of doing the budgets differently and doing it by classification across agency lines rather than by agency silos. This would help that process. I personally think that's a really good idea. This would help that process along by focusing your efforts more on which agency is handling which thing as opposed to taking it across agency lines and requiring that whole interagency discussion to take place, which is always difficult and the handoffs are always cause problems. So we commend this to you. I think these are all pretty good ideas. I hope they will resonate with you. But if not, as I said at the outset, please do understand that this is an important work, but it's quite it'll be controversial. You will get yelled at and beat up. Probably by me, depending on what you do. I'd be glad to take questions.
Thank you. This is really good, specific, useful stuff. Thank you for preparing this. On your second point, putting on your lawyer hat for a second, it's my recollection from working in Washington, D.C., that under the National Administrative Procedure Act, that this is how it works, that agencies have to be shown to be arbitrary and capricious in order to throw something out. So would this just make us consistent with federal appellate standards?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berg, actually the Oregon APA, I believe, I wouldn't want to take a quiz on it, but I think it parallels the federal APA.
Okay, so what's different then? Because
We actually have different appeals processes for a lot of these agency orders. If I can slip over to the land use context for just a moment, again, a long time ago, there's a section of the statute called expedited land divisions, which a form of it showed up in 766, the industrial lands bill last session. And under the expedited format, in that context, we said if you build to a certain density, a certain percent of the base density, I won't bore you with the particulars, then you get this treatment. You get to go no LUBA appeal, it's a shorter permit, blah, blah, blah. Off you go, and the only time you get to appeal is if the hearings officer was related to one of the applicants and forgot to disclose it. The standard fraud, undue influence, ultra vires, those sorts of arguments. And now, again, the problem is, somebody smarter than I would have to look at this, your lawyers would have to look at it and make sure there's not some constitutional issue there. I don't believe there is, because I think the APA, federal and state, says you can structure this, so you can have you're just done at the agency level. But I did take administrative law in law school, but it was a long while ago.
Mr. Chair, to follow up, so specifically, you'd want to get rid of LUBA and have them go directly to the Court of Appeals?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brady, this wasn't land use specific, and actually there is we just had a work group that the Chief Justice and Judge Brewer convened on the impact of land use cases on the judiciary. It's fascinating, actually, and that was not what we concluded, but there are some, and I probably would get ahead of the class if I told you what we concluded, frankly, because I don't wear a black robe. But that was on the table as part of the discussion. Do you have cases go directly from the local government to the Court of Appeals. The issue there wasn't land use reforms, though, in that conversation. It was budgetary impact and the fact that land use cases clog up the Court of Appeals and the fact they're not here, so I'll get to say it for them. They need another panel at the Court of Appeals. So,
okay.
They brought me coffee, so I told them I'd say
so
that.
So just to conclude this line of questioning, that would have two... It would be kind of a two-edged sword. I mean, on the one hand, you might be able to get more efficiency, but on the other, you lose the expertise. And so in the case of land use planning, maybe did you consider eliminating the appeal from LUBA?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brady, the problem there, we did in that context, the problem is you have to have one constitutional appeal. And so one of the ideas, for example, was make LUBA a panel of the Court of Appeals. So that was your one constitutional appeal with no discretionary review by the Supreme Court. The other would be specific of land use cases. That's the snag you run into. This was not intended to be land use specific, although it would certainly have applicability there, potentially, depending on what you did with it.
Senator?
I want to follow up on what Senator Burdick was saying. I think, too, that we need to look at the fact that you need to object to something during a hearing. Because what we have oftentimes, especially in timber sales, is that they go through the hearing and then a separate group will come in and appeal that wasn't involved in the decision. So I think that's something else that maybe this committee could look at, is that if you are going to file an appeal or appeal a decision, you had to be involved in the decision.
Mr. Chair, Senator Grott, I don't want to put Mr. Allen under the bus because he may not have been involved in this effort, but about the same time that we had a discussion about that sort of thing, and we go to the issue of standing, where anybody who showed up at the local decision or the first agency decision would have standing to appeal it, but nobody else. That's a whole interesting set of hearings in your future as well. One thing I ought to mention, too, is, and this is the secret that we don't often tell you, so you're sworn to secrecy, business is its own worst enemy on this stuff. Part of the reason I didn't like number two is the advocate in me always likes to have two more shots at something. If I get told no at one level, I want to be able to try to find a level where somebody's going to tell me yes. That's part of our problem. Many of the regulations that cause the problem that you all are trying to fix are proposed by business organizations or by businesses trying to get out of it to address a particular fact pattern. So somehow we've got to break that cycle. That is the attraction of that. You get a fast yes or a fast no that tends to push back against that, the tendency all of us have to try to rephrase the question in front of some other tribunal so that maybe you get a different answer. But it does make it makes me nervous, certainly, and I suspect my colleagues in the lobby will be equally nervous.
Okay. Jan?
Thank you. Senator Beyer and Chair and Vice Chair Atkinson and members of the committee, thank you for inviting me here today. My name is Jan Meekums. I'm the State Director for NFIB, National Federation of Independent Business. Unlike John, I'm at the opposite end of the spectrum. This is my first work on any task force on government regulation, but it is a subject that is very, very important to our members. And first of all, I'd just like to characterize who are our members. There's a broad spectrum being represented here. We have a lot of members that are also at the HBA, but our members have typically less than 10 employees. And oftentimes they average 3.5, not including the owner or owners. They do not have an HR. They do not have a compliance person, though that is borne by the owner. And so regulations can be particularly onerous on these people. And if you look at businesses such as Nike and Microsoft that started in someone's basement, their garage, one person, could those companies evolve today and be what they are today under the regulatory burden that we have? part of just there are some anecdotals that I've provided that you can read. It's been a long afternoon. I would say ditto to what's been said today thus far regarding ideas and thought processes, potential legislation to be presented that could help this process. There's a lot of very experienced, smart people on this panel that have excellent ideas. If we were to provide you a wish list, it would be that we would encourage a reform holiday. We would love that if that could be worked out, and that there's some type of legislative oversight on rules that have a tendency to be particularly burdensome on business, particularly small businesses. We would like a greater voice at the regulatory process. Being here today started that, being at the table, and I appreciate that very much. Expand on providing assistance to small businesses prior to penalties. It was mentioned, Jeremy mentioned the ombudsman. We were active in trying to promote a business ombudsman last session. It just went to a task force. It didn't move beyond that, which was disappointing. But I think that that's something that can very much help small businesses who don't have a clue how to ferret through the labyrinth of regulation. Another is that every, and this has been mentioned as well, the cost-benefit, the benefit-cost study be done on any regulation, and that there's more transparency and accountability, that we really know and understand how these regulations are created and why and how they will affect our businesses. This is a very complex area, obviously. We didn't get here in a session or two. We won't get out of it in a session or two. But we're committed to help in any way that we can and engage our members in any way that we can to help reduce this complexity. And as we all know, the longest journey does start with the first step. So may this today be a first step in a direction that we really, it's more than talk and something really gets accomplished. And thank you again for today, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Rich.
Sure.
Good afternoon. My name's Rich Angstrom. I'm the president of the Oregon Concrete and Aggregate Producers Association. I'm a survivor of multiple attempts in 15 years I've been doing this particular job of trying to reduce the number of touches on our industry and the regulatory process. I believe that I'm primarily responsible for the failed RIPET process that went on and on, and I can look right down the hall here, line here, and look back here of other folks that were involved in that. That was quite a disaster where we did try to get the agencies to consolidate their activity, and it just turned into a morass. So I fall in the skeptical nature of what can happen given the traditional approaches that we've tried on this. And with that, we are going to be offering in the 2013 session some specific legislation that I've actually worked on this morning and have been working on the last several months that is very specific, but it's slightly different. I finally have come to the belief that part of the issue is that the state agencies run their agencies much like our guys run their businesses, and they defend the jurisdiction of those agencies just as fiercely as our members fight over the bottom line and whether they're profitable. And it's just a reality of when you watch the agency directors interact with one another, when there is these areas where they're overlapping discussions on issues. And it's painful to watch from an industry side of things. I understand how laws develop, but I can tell you a lot of times our smaller members they look at government as government, and what comes out, they think that everybody should be speaking with one voice, and they don't understand why DEQ or DOGAMI or DSL or Water Resources or Fish and Wildlife can all have vastly different views on things. So with that, as if you kind of understand that the agencies defend their silos, and I believe that the best approach and what the legislation will do is more of a passive approach, and what it requires the agencies to do is find ways, it specifically says that the first thing is that any other agency personnel can administer the standards and criteria that have been developed by another agency so long as they have the expertise, the resources to do it. So as an example, let's say the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries has a biologist or a hydrologist on staff. They can administer the standards and criteria developed by DEQ. It doesn't take away from DEQ's ability to set those standards. It doesn't take away from Water Resources' ability to develop their standards. But who applies it shouldn't matter, provided that the administering agency has expertise. And so what this piece of legislation will do is, in a kind of a passive way, is get the state agencies talking together. What we are struggling over is how to mandate this or how to encourage it in an appropriate way. But it's very specific, and it is going to, and what this will do is will ultimately reduce the number of touches that the agencies have on a permitting process or a regulatory process. I don't think we're going to be successful in getting rid of standards and criteria in this state. There's just two vastly different views even within this body sitting here. So if we talk about specific environmental standards and criteria, Senator Burdick is going to have a different view than Senator Starr on those kinds of things. And that's okay. That's okay. But what we should do is we should get the state agencies talking together and finding out ways to maintain those standards but reduce the number of times a state agency has to pick it up. The cost to business every time that happens, and it's a substantial cost, is we have to hire lawyers, we have to hire experts, and we have to redo a lot of times what another agency has already determined to be okay. It's a very bizarre process. So this piece of legislation is specific. It's going to address the number of touches. There's one other component to it, and it actually kind of mirrors what Mr. Chandler said, and I think it's a good idea also, is where a standard is met, is determined to be met by a state agency. So DEQ, we meet a DEQ water quality standard, all right? Well, local governments or some other agency can't pick that back up and say, you know what, we don't think, we also have jurisdiction over that, and we don't think that that's, that determination ends the discussion for us. And then we end up engaging ODF&W or local government, usually in this case, on whether we actually did meet the standard and the state agency was right. Once a state agency determines a standard has been met, it's done. It's done for all levels of government. And I think that's fairly parallel to what Mr. Chandler was saying. These are two very specific things that reduce touches, and that's what we got to do if we want to at least have some regulatory reform. I am with Senator Atkinson that some of the structural problems in Oregon are far greater than what we're talking about just here, as far as capital coming into the state, how business perceives our tax structure, and other kinds of things, how business perceives the state. But on the regulatory front, we can at least address these kinds of things in two specific ways. And you're going to be seeing that from OCAPA. Our style is, and the last thing I will conclude, is the reason I'm going to do this in 2013 is I have talked to the environmental community about it. I think there's some environmental wins here. And it's very important to make sure that I visit with all the state agencies once we come up with the language and have them bring them into support. And by February, I just can't do all of that work. That's our way of doing things, making sure all the I's are dotted and T's are crossed and then come in. At least I'll know if there's where the opposition is. So with that, I conclude some very specific points from OCAPA.
So just real briefly, I have a question for all three of the panelists. Would you support or oppose a move that would require, before agency rules were final, that there was an opportunity for legislative oversight of those rules? Other states do that. It could be a very simple process. The legislators aren't watching those rules, but you as industry representatives would be. It would be an opportunity for strengthening the legislative branch and ensuring that the state agencies were basically following the statutory mandates of the law. I know in the state of Idaho, passed a bill, statute 1 year, the rules are written, they don't become effective until the end of the next legislative session. It allows for the legislature to act. Doesn't require us to review thousands and thousands of pages of paper, but that's what the representatives, industry representatives, could do. Simple question, yes or no?
My goodness, look at the time. Yeah. And I actually, Senator Sarge, if I can elaborate a little bit, after I mentioned the review of the cost-benefit analysis, I was thinking about the rules I've been involved with, for which that would be silly. So there has to be a way to trigger it, and whether details follow, obviously, under your hypothetical, but it seems to me that some way of grabbing rules that are just mundane rules should not be swept up, but the ones that actually do cause a problem, and probably having the interest groups or other third parties be able to flag it up for some legislative review, but does make sense. Reserve the right, of course, to squawk when I see the language, but in concept, you bet.
Same thing, yes, discretionary.
Yes, and I would say kind of the maybe too. There are certain rules that I think are very important that the legislature review, but there's kind of the mundane kind of stuff, or where the legislation is very specific and they're mirroring what you've already put in statute, and it's more perfunctory, that I don't think those are appropriate. But where they're interpreting what you may say as it means reasonable, or some of the broader legislative language, I think is appropriate. If you go down that path, you really want to have a fine knife so it carves out all the stuff that doesn't matter and that we use your time reviewing that's the best. Otherwise, you're just going to get lost and it's going to be an administrative nightmare for you guys.
Just to follow up real quickly, it's not necessary, really. And the state of Idaho does this, and they've done it for years and years and years. The legislature doesn't review the 12,000 rules that are written. It reviews the ones that are flagged, quite honestly, by the industry that are following them.
Yeah.
And with a voice vote, the 12,950 get approved, and the other 50 are then scrutinized, kind of a thing.
Chair Beyer, Senator Starr, I wasn't familiar with the Idaho piece until John Ledger was talking about it, but I can tell you that we all know what rules we don't like as they're being written, and we would be front and center if there was that opportunity to say, they missed the boat.
And it strengthens the legislative branch of government.
Started my list already, Senator.
All righty. Anything else? Senator Atkinson.
Two quick things. Appreciate all the comments, but we've got a structural problem here, and I'm thinking about a piece of legislation that might fix all of this, which would be just to eliminate the legislature.
I think that'd be a constitutional measure.
No, we'll just change the Constitution, because the comments we've made so far have been, we're going to draft legislation and we're going to check with state agencies. We're going to draft legislation and we're going to check with interest groups and then state agencies. We need state agencies to talk together. State agencies talking together is the governor's job. If the governor's not doing his job, that's the governor's job. If the governor's appointing a task force and a commission and saying, well, look, I don't really mean to do anything, I just, appointed a task, that's hold the governor responsible. It's the legislature's job. It was Senator Burdick and I think it was Senate Bill 408 repeal. Well, we brought in very diverse interests, and we fixed that law. Why? Because we had the authority given by the elected people to make all the agencies and the industry sit down, and we made something happen. You have six old hands on this committee that can handle anything you can throw at us. So don't just throw the legislature under the bus to rubber stamp the executive. The legislature, Rich, the reason why it's failed the last 15 years is because you're going to the executive branch to do the work of the legislature. That's why it fails. The legislature, love us or hate us, and I know most people hate us, but the legislative branch of government works. If you take Senator Edwards or Senator Burdick or Senator Starr and say, okay, we've got this, let me use some buzzwords, everyone's paid by them here, a silo of problems around this industry, and Senator Edwards brings together all the water committees and brings together the industry, I'll bet you I would put money on the fact that we would get it fixed. But by putting it into a task force and having special interest groups talk to state agencies, I'll guarantee it'll fail.
Chair Beyer, if I might, and
very quickly, we've got some other things we have to do here.
Senator Atkinson, I hear you, but you know, 15 years I've been here, and you cannot break down the jurisdictional boundaries of these state agencies. I'll tell you, I got a headache for trying to do it. I've tried cajoling, I tried force, and where I'm coming down on is that we need them to have ownership in reducing the number of touches and empower them to do that and provide, just like creating a business opportunity and a regulatory environment for business to be successful, we need to create a regulatory environment for the agencies to be successful. And individual silos don't do it. That we got to break that down, and the only way I can think of doing it that actually has a chance of success is a more passive way where we maintain the standards and we get the state agencies talking with one another and getting opening up who gets to administer a particular silo of rules. That's that's my perspective. It's 15 years, and I've tried everything. So this is where I'm at.
And with that, thank you very much. We now have some possible legislative ideas that have been proposed for. We may see them in December for introduction. I'm going to start off with the good Senator Johnson. You've waited a long time. I gave you a shot earlier. Bring up your crew.
I didn't want to get crosswise with the staff, Mr. Chair. When you're asking for an introduction, you don't make the staff mad. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I have the privilege of representing Senate District 16. I'm here today with Sheriff Tom Bergen, Clatsop County, and J.R. Gonzalez from the PUC. We are bringing you a very specific regulatory reform proposal for the committee's review and hopefully introduction. My two colleagues will describe the bill and ask for your help.
Thank you very much, Senator Johnson, Chairman Beyer, members of the committee. I want to give a very brief summary of what this bill came about, how it came about and got to be there. In 2007, we had the very severe storm that hit three northwest counties in Oregon. During that storm, tens of thousands of trees came down and blocked several highways and entangled with them quite a few miles of power lines. Subsequent to that storm and the declaration of emergency by the governor at the time, several presentations were made here at the legislature to some Senate committees, some House committees. And we also discussed that in several committees outside of the legislature, the Interagency Hazard Mitigation Committee under the Oregon Emergency Management. We discussed what had happened, and we asked that a committee be formed to look into how can we mitigate those kinds of issues from happening again. Committee was formed. We had several members from the private sector, state government, power companies, and law enforcement. And through 2.5 years worth of work, we came up with 11 recommendations. Of those 11 recommendations, we were able to work on four of them, which became Senate Bill 455. I want very quickly to read to you what those four amendments to legislation to the statute would be. The first one, by the way, all of these recommendations addressed statute under the Department of Transportation. The first one exempts the Department of Transportation from the need to obtain local permits before removing trees. That's something that Department of Transportation have to do currently when they're managing the rights of ways. Two, permits the department to inspect and condemn trees that potentially pose immediate and substantial risk of damage or injury by obstructing, hanging over, or otherwise encroaching or threatening to encroach in any manner on state highway. Three, increase the amount of appraised value of forest products required to place forest products for sale at public auction by the department. And four, the Oregon Department of Forestry waives the provision of the Forest Practices Act, which under the reforestation provision requires that like-kind trees be replanted whenever there is a harvest. Obviously, if we have danger trees on the right-of-way coming down and blocking highways, that we don't want those trees to be replanted in those locations. The bill was put forth and didn't happen at the legislative session, so we are here requesting that this Senate bill be given reconsideration, because it does give a tool, a very
great tool for the Department of Transportation to more efficiently and effectively address the rights of ways and remove these trees that are dangerous. I want to state, too, that in my opinion, many of you may agree with me, Oregon is one of the most beautiful states in the Union. And one of the things I love about it is that when you're driving on Highway 26 or going down to the coast, sometimes you go under canopies of trees. They're beautiful during spring, summer, early fall, but during the winter, under ice conditions, snow conditions, or high wind storms, they become a threat. And unfortunately, in 2010, we did have a fatality on a tree coming down and hitting a car and killing the driver. But we've had many of those over the course of many years. We do have, is the video working?
I don't know where to find it. In fact, you might know where to find it.
Well, while I try to find, do you want to talk from your perspective some of the issues that you see?
Chair Beyer and Senators, my name is Tom Berg, and I'm Clatsop County Sheriff, currently serving my second term as sheriff, about 27 years of law enforcement experience. I've been involved with Clatsop County for about 35, 40 years of my life, and some of the most dangerous storms that we see are because of our trees being blown across the road. 3-4 weeks ago, we had another car get hit by a tree that fell across the road. This is a continuous thing. It's been happening for many, many years. When the Forest Practice Act came into place, loggers used to be able to log right up to the roads and clean up and make the highway safe. Unfortunately, after the last 40 years of this being in existence or so, the trees have now grown up and they lean towards the sunlight, which is the open part of the road. The trees then therefore lean. They cause a canopy, which is beautiful for some parts of the places, but other parts you have to remember that when it's cold out on the pass like this morning, or when the sun lights up, you have certain areas that people drive 60 miles an hour, speed limit 55, 60, 65, and then they hit the icy spots that are covered by the shade, causes accidents. The other issue that we deal with a lot is children, young teenagers driving down to the coast all the time to go to Seaside, Lincoln City, Florence, and so on. And they're traveling at sometimes, unfortunately, higher rates of speed. When they get involved in an accident, it's not like a city accident. This is a horrific accident. And they hit a tree that's somewhere as close as 3 feet to the highway. And these aren't trees that are alders that are, 6 inches in diameter that the car could potentially snap. These are trees that are 3 and 4 foot at the butt. So obviously the car stops and teenagers die. We see a lot of that. And some of the main impacts that you'll see in this video are this obviously 2007 was a bad storm, but this is one of the deals that we deal with on an almost daily basis during the end of fall and winter and first part of spring.
You ready? I tried to run a little bit and the volume appeared to not be working, but we'll give it a try here. Is there?
Is that volume?
No.
Here's your volume over here.
Oops.
Oops. That's the volume problem. That's the volume problem.
I put it all the way in.
Volume?
Yeah.
Sorry. I think we get the point.
Unfortunately, apparently the volume is not going to work here. This video was put together by the committee to address the storm of 2007 and some of the issues that have to be dealt with. It suffices to say that this happens fairly frequently in Oregon, and we need to do something about it. We recognize during the discussion process we had some very lively discussions, trust me.
Let me stop
sure.
there because we're going to run out of time. So the bottom line is what you're suggesting in the bill, your one consideration in February that gives, I guess, ODOT authority
correct.
To
yes.
go in and cut trees that present a danger to the public?
Yes. Correct.
Yes.
Senator Edwards.
Quick question. I mean, I understand perhaps they don't have that authority now, but seriously, like, who's checking? I mean, you know, I mean, during a natural disaster, I mean, are there the permit police walking around saying, do you have a permit to remove that tree from the road?
That's an excellent point, Senator Edwards. We had almost 10,000 trees come down over our highways. Seaside, Clatsop County, Astoria was shut off for 9 days. 9 days. That means people not being allowed to come in or out. Myself included, deputies, everybody was out there with chainsaws to try to clear these roads. And to tell you the truth, we didn't give a damn. Mm-hmm. And it was trying to get these things cleared and take care of people being able to get to dialysis and things in the Portland area where you know, medical attention was needed. The other problem was items were not allowed to come into our county as well. And it made it very, very, it was a very dangerous 8 or 9 days for a lot of people, the elderly especially. And so when you go back to the policing issue, I basically told ODOT, you know, whatever you need, let's do it, and we'll worry about it, the consequences later.
If just by way of summary, if I could wrap this up, it wasn't that this bill was debated by the legislature and was not accepted. It just, in the press of business, didn't get considered. ODOT supports it. The PUC supports it because of the utility issues that are involved. The private sector was involved. You see Pacific Corps on here. This is a work product of a long, and I know this is Senator Atkinson's favorite, a long and big task force. And we're just asking for the opportunity to debate it in the February session and hopefully bring relief to public safety and help with disaster mitigation.
Not trying to give it a full hearing today, just trying to let you know what you may be asked to vote on next time. Okay?
Thank you very much.
Thank Sheriff, thanks much. For Thank coming you. Down and spending your time with us.
I'm here.
Probably a whole lot.
I'm here every week anyway. It doesn't seem.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator. Okay, next up, independent.
We'll do insurers.
Captive insurers, excuse me. I jumped too far. Senator Starr, you want to introduce this one?
Yes, thank you, and ask our guest to come up. This is a colleague's bill that we're having introduced. We introduced a bill during the regular session earlier this year. The insurance division honestly asked us to not try to move the bill forward and that they had a lot of things on their plate. These gentlemen are working collaboratively, constructively with the insurance division to draft, get a legislative draft that is one the insurance division will be able to implement. I'm not going to try to define captives. I'll let these guys do that, but it's an opportunity for Oregon to open a line of business in Oregon today that they're having to go to other states to sell. So with that as an introduction, I'll let the men introduce themselves.
Gentlemen, I appreciate your spending time with us today. We're not doing a full hearing here. We're just trying to give an exposure to the committee of what we'll be asked to consider as a bill.
Thank you, Chair Beyer.
And we'll do the hearing in February.
Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Bob Cabasi, and I'm a partner in the law firm of Kell Altman Runstein. I'm one of the ones asking for the legislature to consider this bill. I also want to thank you for your service. I had prepared a speech today, but I see that we're running short on time, and being sensitive to Senator Atkinson's comments, I'm going to skip right to the chase here. The Board of Directors of the Arizona Captive Insurance Association came out with a quote, and I think the quote is apropos. Captives are a non-resource extracting industry employing well-educated individuals. As the industry grows, it directly provides more jobs, and those job holders pay taxes, make purchases, and vote. This type of legislation in Arizona in 2007 alone, according to the directors of the Arizona Captive Insurance Association, made an economic impact of $11.3 million to the state, including $1.4 million revenue to the state of Arizona, without considering taxes that were generated by the state as well. So this does have a direct economic impact. Arizona is one of 29 states that authorize captive legislation currently. Oregon does not. We are proposing that Oregon consider passing legislation to authorize captive legislation. What is a captive insurance company? A captive insurance company is a state-regulated insurance company that has a limited license to serve its parent corporation only. It can be an association captive, and we have discussed branch captives with the department. I believe that a captive can provide business to the state of Oregon. I believe it can bring commerce to the state of Oregon. I believe it provides a mechanism for companies to insure themselves, and I do not anticipate any negative impacts to the insurance division working with them closely. I think it provides stabilization for Oregon businesses, and I think can attract Oregon businesses to this state in a positive manner. What we've done so far is we have previously promoted Senate Bill 969 in the 2011 legislature. We'd like the legislature to consider it in the February session. April 12th, I was before this committee with the insurance division for the purpose of working with the division to get some proposed language. Last week, we received proposed language from the insurance division. We are working closely with them to have finalized language come to the legislature and make something happen. Frankly, after this morning's this afternoon's comments, I'm almost scared to serve on any task force again.
Mr. Chair, I see this not as a task force, but really as the industry working collaboratively with the agency to get a draft that is workable and that the legislature can consider in February. I appreciate the insurance division coming to me and saying during the regular session and saying, you know, we've got so many things on our plate. We would really appreciate if you allowed us to work on this in the interim. That's what we've done, and that's what these gentlemen have done working with the insurance division. I appreciate the you as chair allowing us to utilize one of the committee bills to bring this issue forward. I believe it's going to create jobs and create economic opportunities in our state that's currently being unfortunately done, you know, in Nevada or other nearby states.
So do we have a bill draft back yet?
We are working on one right now, and okay, we should have one very shortly for you for consideration.
Good. Thank you much. Any other comment? You did what you needed to do. Thank you very much, and thank you for your patience in waiting through today.
Thank you.
Mr. Russell, you're last up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations, and I'm going to try to be really brief, so if you have any questions, please interrupt and ask them. This could have been part of the last panel, actually, because it has to do with regulations and independent contractors. As you folks know, the trucking industry has utilized independent contractors for certainly as long as I can remember, although we call them owner-operators. And they bring their truck and they lease it to the trucking company and they drive that truck. And that's how our trucking companies augment their fleets and do all that kind of stuff. And we've been doing it forever. We are also a very heavily regulated industry, which you're also aware of. And because of that, we often don't fit into the traditional regulatory structures. So we have a definition of independent contractors that works for the Department of Revenue and the Employment Department. But it doesn't work for our owner-operators because both the federal government and the state government say that our owner-operators have to work exclusively for a single trucking company. When that happens, they lose their independent contractor status under the normal definitions. So the legislature then provides exemptions for us, as they did in 1987 in ORS 657-047, which basically says our owner-operators are exempt for purposes of employment law and the Department of Revenue. And for 20 years, that worked just fine. And then came the Great Recession, and as our fleets were contracting, some of these folks, their contracts were terminated with the trucking companies because they didn't need them anymore. And some of them went to the Employment Department and filed for unemployment. And the Employment Department granted the unemployment. And when they did that, they said, uh-oh, they've been treating these folks as independent contractors. So they sent that information to their auditors, who then went to visit my members and said, you're illegally using independent contractors. These are really employees. And so we have a number of cases that are wending their way through the process that are dealing with that particular issue. While these cases have been pending, the department has adopted an administrative rule once and then revised that administrative rule. In 2008, they adopted an administrative rule that said if you're going to use owner-operators, and then their name has to appear on the title to the truck. We said, fine. And so we got everybody in compliance with that. Then in December of 2010, they adopted another rule that basically said it's illegal for us to use the traditional model of owner-operators, which we said we can't work with that. So from that point on, from December of 2010, we have been working with the department to change that rule so that it works for us and it eliminates any potential abuse of independent contractors in our industry. So far, we have not been successful. The whole administrative rule focuses on the definition of two words, and the two words are their equipment, which is referring to the truck that the owner-operator provides when they lease on to the trucking company. So the legislative concept that we have basically defines those two words in such a way that we can continue to use our almost century-old tradition of using owner-operators in our industry. Now, having said that, we have not reached an impasse with the agency. So we may not need this bill, but because of the timelines in order to get something ready for February, we needed to get it in and get it started. So we're started. We may come to you in January and say, we've got it fixed. We don't need to do this. Although, having said that, the department has suggested on two occasions that this may require a legislative fix. So we're trying to be prepared and be ready for to go in February. We may not need to. We'll come back in January and give you a status report of where we are with the department. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Bob, one question. I assume that while you're working the administrative rule with the department, you're also discussing language of the statutory change?
Mr. Chairman, yes. We did submit some language. We are waiting for the results to come out of Legislative Council. We, having experienced different language coming out of Legislative Council than we submitted, we're waiting.
The only issue is I don't want to get to where Senator Atkinson's frustration is have us adopt a statute and have the wrong interpretation in rule then coming from the department. So.
Right.
Enough said.
Okay.
Any questions? Senator Drew.
I got one. I know everybody wants to go. This is a real quick one, and I was trying to follow your problem. How does it deal with an owner-operator that's an LLC or a corporation? Does it prohibit that by the rule?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Drew, essentially what it prohibits is...
I understand the leasing company.
It prohibits the owner-operator from obtaining the vehicle from the trucking company or any company that's affiliated with the trucking company. Because truck drivers that want to become owner-operators frequently are not good credit risks. Mm-hmm. The only way they can buy a truck is through the trucking company. So that's normal.
I understand that part of it.
Okay.
Okay, but by what you said, that the name had to be the same as what the license was. And therefore, I'm thinking of somebody that owns their own truck, but if they own it through a corporation or an LLC to minimize their liability, does that apply as well?
Mr. Chair, Senator Girard, no. As long as the entity that constitutes the independent contractor is listed on the title under the 2008 rule, we were okay.
Okay.
Yes. Any other questions for Bob? So you will probably see something that resembles these three concepts in bill form in, I'm not sure, I guess it would probably be January when we do it, the introduction.
Legislative Council is required to get drafts back by the first week of January, and then committees would be able to consider those during legislative days.
So if anybody else has any ideas, we're running out. We've got five. This is three.
We talked about what Chandler gave us. Are you interested in...
I'm interested in all that. I'm not sure how to quite do that. I have to digest it, but if there ideas, you know, based on today that you have, you think things you think we can do, let's talk about it.
Mr. Chair.
We have to talk quick. We have to get a bill request in by 4th or 5th of December.
Mr. Chair, as you look at this list of JTA projects, there's at least two projects that are on the front page here that have been are under construction where the bids came in lower than the amount of money that was allocated in the bill. Those dollars need to be reallocated, and that needs to be done statutorily. I would suggest that we have a committee bill with what I would say would be a broad relating clause that would allow us to deal with that particular issue, but there might be other transportation-related issues that come up. It might be handy for the committee to have a vehicle to address some of those transportation issues.
It makes sense to do that through our bill. I'm trying to preserve bills if we got them. Could we do that in a Ways and Means bill?
I don't know. I would like the...
Tit for tat?
It's probably, it's likely possible, but Mr. Chair, I would propose that the policy committee and that would want to have a pretty significant say in that, and I wouldn't want necessarily the Ways and Means committee to have the complete jurisdiction without the input from the policy committee. When we passed the JTA, it was a product of negotiation, bipartisan, bicameral. You know, the bill started in the House, as you know, the House, and worked its way through both the policy committees and Ways and Means. Whether it's a Senate committee bill or a House committee bill, you know, I think that's something we need to have on our radar screen. There are other projects, even on this front page of this sheet, that the product cost is more than the amount that was allocated in the bill, and it might make sense just to use the current list of projects but do some reallocation, you know, of those extra dollars. It's something that we need to, I believe we should address legislatively in the February session if at all possible, and if we had a relating clause, it would be helpful to do that. And again, you know, I would maybe encourage you to have a conversation with the co-chairs on the House side to ensure that there's a vehicle to do that. Again, whether it's this committee, that committee, it should be a product of a bicameral, bipartisan conversation.
Right. Anything else? Thank you all for bearing with it all this time. We continue the effort to try to find a way to get things moving. I'm not sure we're making headway. We're adjourned.